Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. I really wish I could have called 1-900-288-PILL back in the day. If you thought this year's Royal Rumble sucked, I raise you the Doomsday Cage match. And it's funny to see a fat Vince Russo in the Billionaire Ted sketches. But it's good to know that his career wouldn't be associated with awful skits filled with insider comments forever.
I'm G. John Chase, and I want to talk about the serious issue with the Super Bowl. And that is that nationwide advert selling children insurance for dying children. It makes perfect sense. Do you know what I was pissed off with? The fact that Katy Perry didn't show off her boobs. And on top of that, I'm starting to get addicted to Cocoa Pops. That's what my life is like now. It's all breakfast cereals, covered up boobs and dead children.
Hi, I'm Kieran O'Rourke, and a lot of our regular listeners have asked us to demonstrate what we're like in real life. So here's a true fact about me. Every time I sit on a cold toilet seat, I grimace, clench my fist, and shake it furiously like Kenta Kobashi delivering 100 chops in the corner. Every single time.
And I'm Carl Jones, and in looking back at the first half of 1996, a few things spring to mind. Vince McMahon is more out of touch than Hall & Oates. Me and Goldust have the same tattooist, and I've seen more interesting things in my toilet bowl than I did during the Raw Bowl.
This is the panel for the 29th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us break down the first half of 1996 and the Monday Night War next. Hello everyone, and welcome to the 29th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke alongside G. John Chase.
That's been physical.
Carl Jones.
Yo.
And Kieran O'Rourke.
Ooh, bravo.
And what a show we have. After a few weeks ago, actually a couple of months ago, we did the first part of our Monday Night War history series covering 1995. This is part two, covering the first 6 months of 1996. I want to thank everybody for joining us. You can listen to the first one that we did by subscribing to us on iTunes. We're going to be doing a timeline of the first 6 months of 1996 with notes from the Wrestling Observer newsletter. Thank you very much, Dave Meltzer. And we also obviously have your feedback to get to. So just to kind of recap where we left off at the very end of 1995, Nitro had won 7, Raw had won 6, and 2 were tied. Things seemed to be going in WCW's favour momentum-wise because 3 of the final 4 Nitros of the year were Nitro victories. However, pay-per-view since the war begun had absolutely tanked. December 1995 was a catastrophic month for pay-per-view. In Your House 5 was the worst pay-per-view for the WWF in history, and Starrcade for WCW was the second worst pay-per-view in history. So things aren't looking good. We've got so much to get to here. 6 months worth of notes, so why waste time? In New Year's Day, Nitro and Raw both run. Nitro from the Omni. Flair and Hogan for the belt. I'll just read Meltzer's notes verbatim, actually, on this match. Hogan didn't even go down after on him with brass knuckles. He just turned around and beat up Anderson, Pillman and Benoit, got the nooks and had all four horsemen begging off. The Giant did a run-in with a stool, but Savage got the stool away from him and Hogan beat him up as well. The horsemen scattered and the Giant wanted to go back, but the Zodiac, apparently starting his long-anticipated and highly awaited babyface turn, stopped him, muttering that Hogan was his friend. So this is what you get for WCW, pretty much leaving off exactly where we were from 1995 in terms of the Hogan show, but Flair and Hogan straight away.
Yeah, well, start as they mean to go on. I mean, as we carry on through these months and through the years of this Monday Night War, we're going to see plenty of occasions where they throw away pretty big main event pay-per-view matches on just Nitro shows as they're desperate to try and build any sort of ground on a week in WWE.
The comments by Eric Bischoff as he watched Raw on a monitor were more noteworthy. Early in the show, Bischoff gave away that the Smoking Guns won the Raw Bowl, which we'll get to, I'm sure, shortly, and that it wasn't any good and called it the Toilet Bowl. So he got that joke before you, unfortunately, Carl.
Damn it.
After a sign aired on Raw saying that the WWF was where the bigger boys play, he responded that WCW was where the biggest boys play. WWF did a skit, however, on Raw, on the same day, the very first Billionaire Ted's Wrestling War Room skit, with guys dressed like Ted Turner, Bill Shaw, Harvey Schiller, Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage. The tagline was, "The new generation, still on top of the hill, not over the hill." But noteworthy because this might be, in fact I'm pretty sure it is, the first acknowledgement of WCW in the history of the WWF, correct?
Yeah, it was it's a weird one at the time because to give a personal perspective at this time, I was still WWF fan at the time, massive Shawn Michaels fan obviously. All about loving Shawn in the main events. Whereas, as you've all said, Nitro at this point, really the formula for the next 5 years was well in place. The undercard was, I think you had like Benoit, Regal on that first show of the year.
Yeah.
Something special, but you know.
Anderson gets beat by Savage, I recall, as well. It's like Horseman getting buried, basically.
Yeah. Well, that's it. So just jumping you mentioned briefly there, Meltzer's notes about the Horseman.
That scene.
That scene in itself. as an isolated incident is horrendous. But even before you get there, you've got Anderson being outsmarted by Macho for the win. Babyface has got to get the one up every now and then, but still, it doesn't make Anderson look great. And then you've got Benoit, who loses to Regal by essentially knocking himself out.
Misses a plancher on the floor.
Misses a plancher and gets pinned.
Yeah.
Sorry, Carl, this is this exact same person who was feuding with Hogan this entire time for a year ago. Yeah.
So obviously, billionaire heads wrestling woman, there'll be more of these to come, but again, very shocking. Even when Flair was in the WWF and they had the belt, they never referenced what the belt was. Really bizarre to see this acknowledgement. We said that in the last podcast, looking 95, Bischoff was more than happy to throw the jabs, and the WWF stayed silent and refused to acknowledge that there was any competition. This is the first time where we see Vince's, whether he's cracking up, I don't know what it is, but he's reacting for the first time.
Yeah, I mean, those are quite bad. And then quite interestingly, as we're probably going to get to on the following show, I'd imagine, it's ironic how Eric Bischoff uses those exact adverts as ammunition in their NWO angle.
Indeed. Aside from the billionaire Ted skit, the biggest news was the announcement of Vader in the Royal Rumble. The two sides haven't signed a contract or even agreed to all details, although they've come to an agreement that Vader will start at the Rumble and be in as a regular. So, actually, I quite like the vignette here. He's training in the Rocky Mountains, if you remember that. That's pretty damn good.
Yeah, it's a cool vignette, but I think the way in which he was used in the Rumble, I think, foreshadows a general poor use of Vader throughout his future run with the company.
Yeah. Also, we kind of touched on it there briefly too. The Raw Bowl. If anyone wants to say anything about this was the WWF's first offering, the Raw Bowl, with the Lombardi Trophy handed over by the Brooklyn Brawler, Steve Lombardi.
So, while on
great stuff.
Wink.
While Nitro and McMahon Land are reminding us that their main eventers are old, the undercard for this Raw really just, I was dumbfounded watching it. It felt like it went about half. I think it was half the show, about half an hour. Non stop football double entendres.
Yeah. Timeouts.
Non stop. And I've never heard a commentator work as hard as Vince McMahon doing these lines. And it's for absolutely nothing. It was mind-boggling, quite frankly.
and as if what's happening sort of through commentary and in the ring isn't bad enough, you've even got it cutting to inserts of Brother Love in a sort of a makeshift locker room giving the rah-rah speech, just to add a shit cherry on top of the shit sundae.
it did introduce us to Billy Gunn in the cut-off belly top, though, so...
Oh, yeah.
That's another sign of things to come, I guess.
With the Raw Bowl, did win. 2.6, the WCW's 2.5. Gotta be a surprise considering it went with Flair and Hogan and the momentum that WCW had going into the year.
That's the first time I've heard that number, and I'm absolutely astounded by it. Considering Raw's offering was the Raw Bowl that we alluded to there, and Diesel versus Mabel.
Because we needed that again.
In what? How quickly was that? How quick was that match?
It was very, very.
It was something like 40 seconds.
Yeah, it was very.
That beat Flair and Hogan. Think about that, folks.
Supposedly, there was actually discussion this week of having Eddie Guerrero upset Ric Flair and win the WCW World Title, similar to how Flair made Steamboat in the late 70s in the Carolinas. But you can guess where that got cancelled along the way.
Yeah.
The Ultimate Warrior WWF deal is dead. The Warrior was supposed to come in for the Royal Rumble and was supposed to come in for interviews, but never showed up. And the two signs had other big problems having to do with Warrior wanting a guaranteed contract with astronomical figures. And there were also policy problems that might force WWF into a major double standard if he was brought in. If you can't read between the lines there, folks, it is revealed in later observers that he wanted a testosterone patch and wanted to be able to do whatever he wanted to get his physique looking like the Warrior should look. We can't have that in the WWF.
Yet.
Exactly. We move to Monday the 8th of January. Vince McMahon's second shot at WCW was a cannon. Ties into our last comment here. Billionaire Ted, Nacho Man, The Huckster, and other board members were sitting around a table to come up with a new slogan for Ted's wrestling. The Nacho Man came up with, "This is where the big boys play," and everyone agreed. But then Nacho Man said, "But what if we have to take a legitimate test for steroids?" And The Huckster responded, "Don't worry, we're not in the WWF anymore. The closing line is the WWF New Generation. Nothing old or artificial here." the balls on McMahon to play this card.
Absolutely shameless, that man.
In addition, McMahon claimed he had already written a letter to Ted Turner, then issued a grandstand challenge to Turner immediately after the show in an online message to implement a stronger steroid policy. McMahon released a statement saying the WWF has taken the lead in developing a program with teeth in it. Hopefully Ted Turner will see the value in protecting his athletes as well. This is a company that would cancel steroid testing before the end of the year, just so you know.
It's just it's always this interesting thing that I think, I guess, people forgotten about Vince McMahon due to obviously there being no competition for since 2001. But like when Vince McMahon is in a fight, because we've talked before on previous podcasts about the need for like an alternative, you know, to kind of like create a war again, you know, and create a good kind of creative battle again. We all kind of forget that when Vince is in a battle, and in particular when he's on the losing side, he's a fucking pussy-ass little bitch. He really is. He just whines and moans. He's two-faced. He's
just wait. Just
double
you
standards.
Wait.
It's just like, it doesn't bring out the best in Vince, if there is actually any best in Vince.
No, it just, it exemplifies his belligerent nature, if you like. You know, we talk in sort of the current climate of the way that he may want to elevate certain individuals, and it doesn't matter what people think. These billionaire Ted skits, although it's on sort of a smaller scale, if you like, they're terrible skits. They don't do any favours for the company, but yet he persists with them every single week.
Yes, he does.
I think he was just think about it though, how WCW gloating that's where the big boys play, and he can't steroid test, and he's got these midgets stuck. He was fucking hating his roster, probably. It was like a defence mechanism. The boy crying wolf, and it must have probably killed him inside to say that line about the steroid test, because he wishes they weren't doing it at the time. So it's just, the irony of it is quite amazing.
And I suppose in a sense it's huge blow to his psyche. I mean, we talk about there being no competition now, but let's be honest, from around sort of the end of 88, if you like, through to September of 95, there wasn't really genuine competition, bar a couple of instances when Hogan first comes on board with WCW. I know people will hate that, but there isn't. Whilst there may be good WCW pay-per-views, good talent there throughout that period in time, it doesn't really register in a broader sense.
It's that thing of like the bully at school or something. You pick on someone that's better than you, if you know what I mean. So like, he's picking on the two guys that are the big names in that company, who he knows that are more experienced than the Shawn Michaels and the Diesels and so on. And so it's just like just him prodding and just going, not fair. You were mine first.
Yeah, it was like your analogy at the end of the 95 podcast, where you said that so at this point it's two kids in the schoolyard yelling at each other, and no one wants to actually throw the first real punch. And to Vince, this was throwing a punch. It's more like throwing a stick from a distance.
You stole my friends. They're my friends first.
To counteract that, we're still on January 8th here. The WWF also did two brief skits with a character called Scheme Gene, parodying the 900 line commands. WCW on Nitro announced Viewer Appreciation Month, saying that they're putting the best matches on free television this month in the form of the Clash of the Champions as a thank you present. Well, the WWF is raising the price of their pay-per-views. Bischoff called the Rumble the Royal Fumble and referred to WWF as Titanic Sports. He's very happy to jab the needle into Vince here, ironically enough. And again, before the show, actually, on January 8th, an interesting note here from The Observer. They did a test of crowd reaction because they were going to have Hogan and Savage do an interview to air during Thunder in Paradise, which preceded Nitro. But the crowd booed the mention of Hogan and Savage's name so much they decided against it. So nothing's really changed there. Hogan's still being booed on these live shows.
No, and if anything, at that point, it's picking up steam.
It is picking up steam. The main event has Hogan and Savage over Flair and Anderson on Nitro when Hogan leg drops Anderson. Meltzer describes this as just terrible. On Raw, however, they replayed the entire Bret Hart British Bulldog match from In Your House 5 in a quest for ratings, where Bret Hart got bloody and they advertised the blood. And
great match.
Fantastic match. Both Nitro and Raw, as a result, drew their best numbers since the Monday Night Wars began this week. Raw gets a 3.0 to Nitro's 2.8. There's a note from The Observer here as well. They may change the Goldust character up. This is obviously as he started the feud with Razor Ramon. There have been lots of complaints from fans at the arenas because he's fondling himself at the live shows, which I just absolutely love. But Goldust, one of the standout characters for the first few months of 1996.
When people always talk about the Attitude Era, and they're always trying to find the first benchmark of the Attitude Era. And they'll always go back and say, like, oh, it was Austin at Mania, or it was the NWO, or it was Austin 316 at King of the Ring, and so on. And it's kind of strange. There's kind of, like, elements to it with, like, the Gold Dust character. I'm not going to turn around and immediately say that Gold Dust was the beginning of the Attitude Era, but, like, Gold Dust as a character was certainly so far removed from what they'd been doing in 93 and 94. I don't know. He really kind of stood out, and not just through the point of, like, the whole homosexual kind of vibe that he was having, but just like the whole presentation of them, the design of the outfits and so on, and the name and
music.
Everything. Yeah, the music. It was just like a completely different type of production for a character compared to anyone else that was on that roster at the time. You know, the Bretts, the Razors, the Diesels, and so on. It's just like really interesting to see that this character just like just plonked right in the middle of this company.
I don't think it's obviously not this week. It has this Goldust controversy gets a bit more steam, but I might as well mention it now because it's just a random thing. I think King, who's a heel on commentary, and Vince are talking about it, and at one point Jerry says a comment, Vince shoots it down, and Jerry's like, oh, you're only saying that because you're homophobic, Vince. And Vince goes, you're damn right.
Like, there's another one where Vince is doing a promo in the ring with Goldust saying, and this is the one where Goldust says, is that a spare microphone in your pocket? Are you happy to see me? And Vince is like, some people say that you're preying on the homosexual fears that most men have.
I.e.
me. Yeah, fantastic stuff there. We move to January 15th. The wrestling war got stranger when Eric Bischoff on This Nitro, who started the television name-calling campaign, abruptly shut up, and WCW ignored all the barbs thrown in their direction this week. The Public Enemy debuts against the American Males, but again, they throw Flair versus Sting and Luger versus Savage on this show for free.
Noteworthy that Luger Savage opens the show.
Yeah, and Luger wins pretty much clean.
Oh, it's absolutely clean. Savage misses the top rope elbow. They're still playing off the arm injury at this point.
They didn't have back in November.
They didn't have, you know. God, they showed everyone else, didn't they?
They sure did.
But there's still the playoff. That Savage misses the elbow and he gets torture racked and submits.
Yeah, that's it. This is quite surprising.
But I don't think so at all, because I mean, like, it's just it just feels like it's still a part of that initial push that they were obviously giving Luger when he came back into the company, and as we continue on looking at the next few months or so, it kind of continues as well all the way through there. It's just kind of like,
yeah, but look at it in context. This is babyface Randy Savage doing a clean job on TV by submission to a Luger who at this point is not really babyface or heel.
Yeah, isn't that weird kind of tweener mix? Luger was actually a charm during this period. Yeah, I didn't realise how good he was.
Yeah, he's positioned as the dick, and like the only person who likes him is Sting. It's like, yeah, it's quite entertaining, really.
But there's a great moment, a clash that I'll mention as we get to it, involving Sting and Luger, which is just awesome. Just move on to Raw that night, January 15th. The Billionaire Ted sketch airs. It implies that Turner tried to buy the WWF, but he couldn't. That he wished he had Shawn Michaels instead of Hulk Hogan. And that all WCW was able to buy from the WWF was a con man in Gene Okerlund, someone disloyal in Randy Savage, and a has-been from the 80s in Hulk Hogan.
That's all they've got, as we'll see when the fake Razor and Diesel rock up. Yeah. They were desperate at this point, so... Yeah, and as well as the Scheme Gene skits for people that haven't seen them, were basically... Gene would be promising information if you called his hotline, then he wouldn't deliver anything, and it was just old information that he'd heard early on the show, and that was that was the whole skit for Scheme Gene.
So real life then?
Yeah, pretty much.
The highlights from the January 15th Raw was a video feature on the returning, soon to be returning, Shawn Michaels, and a great hallway brawl with Razor Ramon and Goldust. This is where they fight in the snow, if I'm not mistaken, and Razor throws the garbage can at his car as it speeds away.
Yeah, this comes after the tattoo skit, doesn't it, after the match where Goldust zips down to reveal the heart-shaped tattoo on his chest.
With
Razor through it, which sets Razor off. Just out of curiosity, do you have the numbers there for that Raw and Nitro?
I do indeed, and there's a great story behind this. WCW won the Monday Night Ratings War this week with a 3.5 to the WWF's 2.4. The margin of victory, the largest to date by either side, prompted Eric Bischoff to call Vince McMahon, who didn't take the call, but Bischoff left a message with the secretary telling McMahon to continue whatever it is he's doing with Billionaire Ted. The ball's on Bischoff!
must be the worst winner of all time. He's a great man.
Only because you'd mentioned there that the previous week was the highest audience share for the two combined. And I was just curious to see, is this more of the start of the groundswell where whilst one may be handily beating the other from a sort of week-to-week ratio, you're seeing a gradual sort of upswing in audience viewing in general?
We'll track that as we go along. An interesting note from this observer. Whatever problems that Bischoff had, which caused him to nearly fire Brian Pillman on the air the previous week, seem to have been worked out. It's funny reading these observers, because Meltzer was absolutely buying Pillman, hook, line, and sinker, until a certain point. This was the start of the loose cannon stuff. He'd begun acting weird at the end of 995, and we start to get little traces of quirky behaviour from Pillman involving, like, spitting on Alex Wright and spitting on cameras and stuff, and Bischoff was talking about how we don't expect to see Brian Pillman here much longer.
Oh, and Anderson slapping the piss out of him.
That was great. That great segment.
Yeah. I guess, this is obviously the beginning of this absolutely fantastic Pillman, where he's just working everybody around him. And just like when I was just talking about the gold dust being like just sticking out like a sore thumb in WWF, I think like Pillman is like the gold dust over there. Like he just sticks out with this gimmick. He sticks out like a sore thumb compared to the old red and yellow Hulk Hogan.
In the Observer, it notes there are changes to the Royal Rumble, big changes, with Sid out of action with a disc problem in his neck. The tag team title match was changed to the Body Donners as challengers for the Smoking Guns. Sid and the 123 Kid were set to win the tag titles, but they may have missed their opportunity here. The WWF agreed to use Sabu for the 1996 Royal Rumble. They were going to allow him to bring his own table and break it by diving over the top rope and eliminating himself so he could get his gimmick over on a major pay-per-view show, and they were also going to allow him to use his name. Paul Heyman put the kibosh on it. The WWF then taped Royal Rumble promos with Sabu's name being part of the show during the latter part of the week, and the WWF even announced on its hotline that Sabu from ECW would be in the Royal Rumble. Pritchard then offered Heyman several WWF wrestlers to work ECW in exchange for using Sabu, but Heyman said he wasn't interested. Heyman then put the pressure on Sabu once again, and Sabu finally backed out of the deal. So after Sabu had been pretty much gobbled up and spit out by WCW at the end of 95, he had a chance here to get in with the WWF, and Heyman didn't want it.
It seems to be the way for Sabu, doesn't it? You look at 95, then you mentioned 96 there, and then the wranglings further down the line with WCW in 2000. It just seems whenever he was about to get that platform, the rug was just pulled out for whatever reason. From my perspective, I would say mercifully, considering his later WWE run.
Another cool note here. All WCW wrestlers now have to leave the belts with company officials after television tapings rather than carry them with them, as WCW is paranoid after the Medusa situation last year of a retaliation taking place. So at least somebody was thinking.
Yeah.
In one regard.
Don't they know if the guy's under contract or not? Wouldn't that just be easy to track?
You'd think so, wouldn't you? Which leads us to the Royal Rumble 1996 on January 21st. Interesting, we can get into the content of the show shortly, but pay-per-view sources pretty well confirm a 1.1 buy rate, which would be 265,000 buys, a figure that defies explanation given the trends in the industry of late. The number of buys more than tripled the December pay-per-view, even though this show saw a price increase to $29.95. Out of nowhere, the Royal Rumble does an amazing buy rate, even though pay-per-view's been dying for the last 4 months since this Raw Nitro War got started. The Rumble just jumpstarts.
All I can think of is that it was a Royal Rumble, and that was the gimmick of the show itself that probably drew, or maybe the fact it was the road to WrestleMania or something. I can't think what else was on that show besides Shawn Michaels' return, but I wouldn't think, I know we have Shawn Michaels fans here, but I couldn't think that Shawn Michaels' return in a Rumble would create that sort of boost.
Just to counter that point, and there was a note that I was going to read later on, but we'll get to it now. The first week of Shawn Michaels' house shows were the best house shows in over a year. So it actually was Shawn Michaels who was the draw for the show, and he was a short-term draw shortly after the Rumble as well.
Yeah, and you've got to remember, they had done a very good job towards the tail end of 95 and into the start of 96, tugging on the heartstrings, if you like, with the Michaels vignettes and the concussion and the way they played that. They did that very well. So it garnered some sympathy for Michaels. I don't think it can be understated, though, the fact that this is the Rumble, and the Rumble does always draw extra eyeballs that other pay-per-views wouldn't.
I don't know, maybe would Vader be something to do?
I think there'd be some intrigue with Vader as well, yeah.
There's a lot of weird one-shot deals on this show. You remember guys like Doug Gilbert being in the Royal Rumble?
Doug Gilbert.
Jake returns for this too.
Jake returns and gets a good pop. doesn't look in the best of condition. Something which would not improve as the year went on. Then they saw Karma come back after disappearing for some time.
He'd given notice that towards the end of the last year that like Karma was another guy who won the one shots. Tatanka also came back for this.
Yeah, it's funny. You look at the WCW roster at this time and some of the guys that they're bringing in, so more sort of tail end of 95, you look at them bringing in like sort of Benoit and Guerrero. And you go over to the other side and Vince brings in a past his prime Jake Roberts, Tatanka, a one-shot deal for the SWAT team.
Oh yeah, I forgot about this. The
headhunters.
Quiz.
Trying to get Warrior.
To get Dan Severn. The show began with a disclaimer saying that due to the graphic nature of the show, that parental discretion is advised. Diesel gives the middle finger in the main event here, which is actually quite interesting. To Bret Hart and I think actually to the Undertaker. Oh. I think at the end of the match. Very, very interesting, because we would see little traces of this to come. But again, you mentioned it with Goldust, we mentioned it at the end of last year where they were taking on a rougher edge, blood on pay-per-view, things of that nature. But we're seeing it here again.
And although it's only minor at this point, there's sort of an element of sexual overtones, if you like, because you mentioned the disclaimer at the start.
Which leads to Sunny.
It starts with Sunny in the bathtub, talking about graphic nature with a glass of wine, and she starts flirting with the smoking guns during the tag match and shaking her ass sort of thing. So, you know, there's little... whilst G gets aroused here, I'm just trying to make the point, as uncomfortable as I feel right now, that there's elements there, if you like, even if Vince isn't willing to commit.
Yeah, and we actually see these disclaimers for quite a while now. They do it on Raw, they do it on pay-per-views as well.
I think the following pay-per-view the month after, I think they do another
Sunny on the beach.
So that there's those elements there, but Vince is still... He can't break away from that family-friendly vibe that he likes so much, even with a character like Goldust. As we've said before, it's sort of a standalone element to the show.
And the Sunny vignettes as well pretty much consist of her saying, "I like it raw!" And that's it.
Oh yeah, we were a good year away from the Elmo sex tape.
Oh god, I forgot about that. Both sides, Nitro and Raw, go at it hard. I wouldn't use that line. Raw and Nitro come out with both guns blazing. How about that? On January 22nd, the night after the Royal Rumble, among the other major angles was the return of Roddy Piper to the WWF as the figurehead president, leading to another step in adopting a wilder style of wrestling to try and copy ECW. This came after an injury angle where Vader, who has not yet signed a WWF contract, was suspended for stretching out the figurehead president Gorilla Monsoon, one of the best angles for either group in years.
Well, yeah, I mean, in terms of that, in terms of Vader and the angle, I mean, we were just watching that
right before we started,
and because I've never really seen that angle all the way through. I've only seen like the highlights of it. It's strange because there seems to be a positive start to Vader in this company. You know, like the vignettes are pretty good, and like he's been brought in as this big bad kind of monster, and I don't know. It's just like, they definitely seem to have had an intent with him when they signed him up, but it just kind of like, it just fizzled out.
The commitment wasn't there long term.
And it'll be interesting to see exactly when, because as we're doing this timeline now, it'll be interesting to see exactly when and how long the fizzle out takes for Vader.
I would argue it didn't take very long at all. And people can disagree with me if they want, please jump in here. I think the skit with Monsoon is the only good thing they did with Vader during his entire run.
There's one more thing that sticks in my mind, we'll get to that.
Maybe I'm forgetting that and you'll get there, but there wasn't, I don't think they ever really committed to Vader that much. If you look at his Rumble entrance, if you like, he does a few bits and pieces, but he's not made out to be a complete killer, and the fact that Sean dumps him and Yoko out together is pretty much all she wrote on Vader that night.
I think meanwhile over on Nitro, didn't Bischoff address the Vader exit by he didn't return his papers in time for the match? I can't remember.
At War Games, was it?
Vader was AWOL.
That was the one.
He was AWOL. Yeah. Also on Raw this week, along with the big angles, Triple H versus Razor Ramon and Bret Hart, the WWF champion, against Goldustein's Continental champion. On Nitro, to counter this, Randy Savage captures the WCW World Championship from Ric Flair.
Yeah!
Hulk Hogan comes out and challenges for the title. The fans immediately booed Hogan.
Yeah.
Luger and Sting win the tag team titles as well from Harlem Heat. Two big title changes, the first world title change on Monday Night Television at this point.
And again, it's worth pointing out, who wouldn't boo Hogan in this situation? He comes out while Savage is making his entrance, I believe. I may be getting the chronology there, but I believe it's during his entrance that he asks to be the first challenger, should Savage win. Yeah, real jam-up guy there, Hulk Hogan.
Politician to the bitter end.
Absolutely. And it's worth pointing out again, this title change opens the show.
Yeah.
Can you imagine it in the climate of 96, if you like, sort of people more older than us with further back memories, can you imagine sort of proposing to them, right, we're going to change the title, we're going to do it on TV, which no one's had to pay for, so you know, we're doing this for free, and it's going to open the show.
But I guess it's just like, it's just a blatant show of what Bischoff's mindset was at this point in the war, because it was just like, I'm going to have to grab the audience like straight away. And I'm guessing he was thinking that the best way of doing that is putting the main event on first. He goes, if I can grab them straight away, so as soon as, you know, the clock ticks, you know, on the o'clock or whatever, and you know, I can get them tuning into WCW
and deliver.
I've got them. I can then try and keep them. I'll keep them all the way because there's another title match later on with Sting, who's very popular anyway. Yeah.
Well, it's a precursor to Bischoff's philosophy throughout the entire war. You know, whilst we think of pay-per-views as being the real business metric to a healthy company during this period, and throughout the 90s and 2000s, Bischoff is obsessed with the Monday night ratings, and that's what you've got to remember. They're owned by essentially, you know, the Turner Network, and they're a TV based company, so you can see why that philosophy is all about those ratings figures and not necessarily the traditional view of house show revenues and pay-per-view business.
On the network, when I was watching one of the Legends of Wrestling roundtables, and he turned around and absolutely confirmed it and said, from his game plan perspective, it was just like, that's how he was going to beat the WWF, because he said, if I got great figures for the TV, then he firmly believed that the pay-per-views will sort themselves out. Because that's how he wrote it in his head. Like, he was just saying, like, if everyone tunes in and sees a show, then the pay-per-views will sort themselves out. So that's why he didn't worry so much about the pay-per-views and why he put pay-per-view quality matches on TV.
What I thought, watching at the time, and it's quite relevant now, this kind of thing with Bischoff in terms of, you know, mixing and matching, you know, titles going on in peculiar places, shall we say, it kind of, although they had a deeper roster, it felt almost like WWE today, where it was all these guys, especially at the top of the card, you had guys who were probably main eventers in WWE at the time, like Flair, Savage, not so much Hogan. Hogan's probably the only one who was protected, but Giant, all these guys. Just none of them stood out, even though that, you know, there was a lot of depth there, and they're obviously expensive as well. The mixing and matching of the title and the swapping of the title, it was, while Hogan was still the priority, you know, they talk about Hogan all the time still anyway, that to me kind of, yeah, none of them, although they had the deeper roster, they kind of, it was already devaluing them in terms of everyone's on the same interchangeable level, which is kind of, you know, is a well-known problem today kind of thing. But yeah, that's something that stood out to me, and yeah, it's interesting watching that back.
It's interesting to notice here, because to me, the first few episodes of Raw of the Year, they seem really flat. The actual production of the show, it seems Nitro does have so much more energy in the first month than Raw does. Raw, again, you see matches like the Smoking Guns versus the Spiders on one of these episodes of Raw. It's just, there's just a very generic, pre-taped, pre-fabbed feeling about Raw. It's all very produced, and it doesn't have the flow and the energy that Nitro does, even if, like you say, Kieran, there is a lot of interchangeable parts.
Yeah, I think this was still, as you know, all those the things Chase said about Bischoff. He was in the mindset. He was in the war. I think, although Vince, you know, they were fighting with the billionaire Ted and stuff, I don't think, yeah, he was still grasping with the kind of like the rules of engagement himself at that point.
I think in terms of the rules of engagement, I think the only way he was grappling with them was how many of them he could break.
Look at the billionaire Ted stuff. I mean, that's, if that's all you've got to, as a riposte, then
surprising ratings result here. The WWF's Raw show gets 2.9 to the 2.7. So all the title changes on Nitro didn't actually win the night, even. the reason Bischoff did this is because it was one night after the Royal Rumble, and he was trying to counteract the post pay-per-view bump that traditionally happened, but it didn't work. The WWF won the night. Same level of audience, just kind of narrowed out a little bit. January 23rd, one day later, the Clash of Champions, Miss Elizabeth and the Road Warriors return to WCW. This show gets a 4.5 rating and was the most widely viewed wrestling television show in the history of TBS. Not the highest rated. It was the same rating Hogan Flair match from 94, but Cable was in more homes in 96, so there were more viewers. After losing the WCW title, Ric Flair threatened to quit the promotion at the Clash when he found out that he was originally scheduled to get leg dropped again. Even with the return of Elizabeth and the secret weapon of Kevin Green in the corner, which got a lot of press because this was pre-Super Bowl for the Steelers, the result of the match was switched to appease Flair, with Flair and Giant beating Hogan and Savage when Flair used the Nux to pin Randy Savage. Even after getting the win at the Clash, Flair was still making noises about wanting to leave because he was unhappy at the direction and push he thought they were going to give him.
You mean the usual push of the job boy bitch to Hogan?
Pretty much. Okay. Also on the Clash, notable for the Brian Pillman, Bobby Heenan, what the fuck are you doing moment on live TV, which is just fantastic and just did more to add that little spark to Brian Pillman and make his stuff seem that much more real and that much more different.
And surprisingly, something that has not been edited off the network's
really?
Showing of that Clash of Champions.
I didn't know that. They do a great segment, if you saw it, where Sting and Luger, the Road Warriors, when they debut, they approach Sting and Luger and want a title shot. And Sting is all gung-ho and says, yeah, we'll do it. And Luger cuts in and says, no, we've got a lot of other teams who've got to wrestle first, like State Patrol. Luger had his moments during this period of time. I don't realize, I always had this anti-Luger thing. God damn, he's funny in retrospect. Eric Bischoff responded on the WCW hotline to the WWF skits. He laughed at the WWF, crying foul on steroids. Clearly, he's a desperate man doing desperate things. I feel sorry for Vince McMahon if he has to hire imposters to draw a number on his pay-per-views. He then finished by saying that Vince McMahon was the Vern Gagne of the 90s and that his time had come and passed. That had to sting.
You know that remark.
That fucking had to really piss him off. January 29th, the WWF is clearly the aggressor this week in the Monday Night Wars, bringing up a letter sent by Eric Bischoff threatening legal action for the billionaire Ted skits. The letter was referred to on several occasions and even shown on the air once. The WWF attempted to position themselves as not backing down from legal threats from the bully Ted Turner. The billionaire Ted sketch this week also has the Hookster character saying, "It's in my contract with billionaire Ted that I never lose." Again,
oh, what the fuck?
Talk about massive change in the business. They're acknowledging something like that on TV.
Jesus, babe.
How absolutely bizarre is that?
I didn't know they did that. Wow.
Bischoff, who had kept quiet on Nitro for 2 weeks after the piece aired, responded completely out of nowhere during the Road Warriors entrance with, "Forget about it, Vince. Get a job at a pizza parlor." So they're just slinging mud back and forth here. On Raw this night, the 29th, they showed a clip of Cactus Jack, actually his ear. He's coming in. I believe the working idea for his ring name is the Mutilator.
How did you guys all see Foley's chances in WWF with this particular character, considering he spent the majority of his career being Cactus Jack?
I think the most notable thing for me at the time was I thought being placed against The Undertaker was the kiss of death long term, and how wrong I would be. Well, but we'd seen the pattern with Taker.
Well, that was it, and we've got to remember that. I may be just speaking for myself, but I had no knowledge of Cactus Jack. I had no knowledge of Mick Foley's background prior to this. I have, in retrospect, watched as much Foley stuff as I can. I'm a complete and utter Foley mark, but all I knew was this was a guy called Mankind who was coming in and was going to lose to The Undertaker.
Yeah. I mean, we knew Cactus Jack because we'd seen him on WCW.
Yeah. I think it was a bit of trepidation at the time because, they're going to, you know, he's a decent guy. Obviously, he wasn't like a super megastar at that point, but he's a decent guy, he's a fresh guy. But they're gonna make him into one of their bullshit characters again, just like Goldust at that point. It was like, being young, my angst was Goldust. It started off, you know, oh, we know who's Dustin Rhodes already. What are you doing that for? He's a decent guy. I want to see him. Yeah, and I think it was more the same. It was, I'm not going to get to see this guy really be what I think he can be because he's like a shit gimmick and he's going to lose to Undertaker and be gone. So,
just from Foley's point of view, that's a shit fucking deal, isn't it? Just like, you know, you're giving this mask a completely new character, no money, and you're giving Undertaker, who's just floundering.
But you've got to remember, he's working in ECW, so he's not making a boatload of money there. He's not making a boatload of money for his matches in Japan.
He's getting blown to death for it, too.
He's getting absolutely
blown to death.
He's putting his body through absolute hell for not big payoffs. and he's supplementing that with his t-shirt money. He mentions that enough times in his book. Screw the match, I had t-shirt money to make. So even given the WWF's sort of floundering nature at the time, what's he got to lose? You know, if it doesn't work out, he can always go back to ECW. They're not going to say no.
Always go back to Japan.
Always go back to Japan. You can always continue to sell t-shirts.
Okay, listen to this lineup. So they have that Diesel and Davey Boy Smith, and Sean's first TV match back after his concussion against Yokozuna, but Nitro wins with a 2.8 for another Flair versus Hogan match against Raw's 2.4. On that Flair-Hogan match, Meltzer writes, in something people thought they would never live long enough to see, Hulk Hogan puts Ric Flair over for the first time. This is the match with the high heel in the eye. Hogan bleeds and lays down for the three. Meltzer adds here, the result probably stemmed from all the noise Flair had been making about wanting to quit over the past week, because he didn't like them taking the title off him so quickly, and he felt that he was going to be used as Hogan's stepping stone. Nah! This match was originally booked for a Hogan leg drop finish, and Flair had agreed, but as happens on a fairly regular basis, Hogan showed up on Monday and changed the booking! We've also heard that Flair was given a bonus of a small raise, besides being put over to keep him from leaving. Interesting point here, though, because we're seeing a leverage amongst the wrestlers that didn't exist previously because of the situation that we're in, which does play in very, very shortly.
Well, that's it. In the 80s, it was the talk of a need for a union for the boys. By the time you've reached this stage, it's very much a case of, well, Jesus, there's two companies that are doing relatively good business. Let's play them off against each other. Let's try and create this bidding war, which you would eventually parlay into Brian Pillman's line of thinking.
Absolutely, and we'll come to that very, very shortly. Just to show how paranoid everything is, the fire alarm went off this week on Nitro, and people immediately thought it was a dirty trick played by the WWF.
Like Vince snuck in with a balaclava and pulled the alarm.
Yeah.
Well, man, let's face it, when we're talking about this in the context of a war, at this point McMahon's only firing a water pistol, so...
The February 5th Nitro, one week later, during a television main event, a WCW tag title match with Sting and Luger versus the Road Warriors, the power in the Lakeland Civic Center goes out for several minutes. Bischoff, when the show came back on, made insinuations that it was an act of sabotage in a heated war, saying, I wonder how that happened, and desperate people do desperate things.
The Road Warriors didn't exactly have their working boots on at this point, did they?
No.
As referenced, you mentioned that match wasn't good. I believe it was their return match with... were they dubbed the Faces of Fear at this point?
Mangan Barbarian
was an absolute shocker as well.
That was on the previous week.
And it's worth pointing out that the Road Warriors have always claimed during that period that they didn't have a contract. It was all verbal, which is why they were able to leave in such a hurry.
This is also the Nitro, February 5th, with a very bizarre Pillman-Anderson versus Sullivan-Morris match, where it looks like Sullivan and Pillman start going at it in the middle of the ring. Sullivan goes for Pillman's eye. Very bizarre match, and Meltzer completely buys it hook, line, and sinker.
Yeah. Was the booker at this point as well.
Sullivan's the booker, yeah.
Yeah.
Countering this, Raw. Yokozuna and Davey Boy versus Shawn and Diesel. Hakushi versus the 1-2-3 Kid, and a rematch from the Rumble, Bret Hart versus The Undertaker. A very stacked lineup considering the standards of what we've seen before. And WCW, even with a power cut, wins the Monday Night Ratings battle with a 2-9 to WWF's 2.7.
And also, you know, obviously not a marquee match, but 1-2-3 Kid Hakushi, did you say?
Yeah, it's really fun day card stuff.
Good one, yeah.
And I believe that the billionaire's Ted skit this week as well had the Hookster referencing getting attacked with a shoe, I think.
That's right, yeah. Is this the one where someone holds up a shoe and he backs off?
Yeah.
February 11th, a few days later, it's Super Brawl 6, an interesting show. Liz turns heel and goes with the Nature Boy Ric Flair to get him the WCW World title back.
Harlot.
Slut.
Oh, yeah. Also, Brian Pillman, I respect you, Booker Man. Very, very noteworthy, newsworthy thing. Yeah. Pillman appears to be leaving the company at this point. Wink, wink. Terrible show otherwise. The debut of Loch Ness, Giant Haystacks, comes in here for a very disastrous run in the company, Carl.
Oh, well, I think there were actually more sightings of what is perceived to be the actual Loch Ness monster as opposed to sightings of Loch Ness in a WCW ring.
I believe it was around this time, though, that Mongo on commentary was putting over, you know, how WCW was the place to be, and champions from around the world like Loch Ness coming in are an example of that. So,
God damn.
Good one, Mongo.
Yeah, still take him over the current announced team, though, on Raw.
He clearly wasn't doing his rails that night. No.
Super Bowl does a 0.63 buy rate for 148,000 buys. Then would be slightly higher than Halloween Havoc last year, but a huge increase over World War III and Starcade. So numbers are picking up for WCW as well on pay-per-view. Nitro the next night. With no competition, the show sets a record doing a 3.7. And in even more shocking news than the previous job that Hogan did, Arn Anderson pins Hulk Hogan on Nitro. Loch Ness debuts in a match and just absolutely sucks ass against Scotty Riggs. Just terrible. Wow. Double A gets a big win. How can you not love that?
Oh, you've got to love that. And it's just...
Although Arn does get the shit kicked out of him the whole match and then gets beaten up afterwards, but never mind.
You know, typical Hogan. I'm going to make sure he has the heat. But it just goes to show how much the landscape has changed during that period of time. The notion of... I mean, contrasted with the 80s, Hogan, if he ever appeared on TV, it's for an interview skit. Or it's some sort of... video package, if you like. Hogan's not wrestling on TV in the 80s and in the early 90s. It's just not happening. Contrast that to the point where he's wrestling weekly on TV and losing on TV on two consecutive weeks. Now, we can talk about the nature of those defeats and whether or not a loss is really a loss when the Hulkster's involved. But still, if you had suggested that to anyone even a year earlier, they would have just looked at you like you'd grown an extra head.
Bischoff was forced by TBS lawyers to apologise on the air during Nitro on February 12th for insinuating that the WWF caused the power failure. He claimed his remark wasn't meant seriously. He's also been put under a gag order against making any comments either on television or in the media to respond to anything McMahon has said until after the Time Warner merger goes through.
Oh, well, that clearly worked.
Oh, yeah. The following week, Vince McMahon comes out with all guns blazing in this no-holds-barred war with the opposition, which he claims isn't WCW but the whole Turner Empire. Among his manoeuvres over the past 7 days are filing a complaint with the Federal Trade Commission claiming that TBS has been engaged in a systematic plan to destroy the WWF so it can achieve a monopoly over the wrestling business. Bastards.
Oh.
Taking out quarter-page ads on both Wednesday and Thursday in the New York Times financial section, headlined, "Attention TBS stockholders," with a drawing of Turner, and underneath, copy that read, "Does Ted Turner have a personal vendetta against the World Wrestling Federation? Time Warner beware!"
He must have. Shitloads of fans who read the Wall Street Journal.
Because God knows, CNN is gunning for the WWF.
Absolutely. Also, they have Jerry McDivitt send a letter to Bischoff demanding the apology for Bischoff's televised insinuations, which is the apology that we heard on Nitro, and he also wrote a letter to Ted Turner complaining about WCW reinstituting blading and promising bloodbaths on the Super Bowl pay-per-view. Incredibly hilarious, considering the fact that they aired Bret Hart's blade job on Raw a few weeks earlier.
Yeah. These back and forth lawsuits and little notes, this was the world before Twitter, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah,
it's all loose ethics and loose morals in this war.
McMahon admitted during the week that as recently as the past 2 weeks he's had discussions with the USA Network about moving Raw to a new time slot, with him mentioning Mondays at 10 p.m. in specific. He said he's wanted to move the show almost from the beginning of the Monday Night Wars, but the USA Network didn't agree to it. So there you go, very interesting.
So he wanted to go from 10.
He wanted to go to 10 o'clock.
So what were the current times?
8.
They were both head-to-head 8?
Yeah.
So, okay.
McMahon also complained... This is like the Vince McMahon whinge week. Vince McMahon complained of contract tampering, bringing up in specific Diesel. He claims Diesel was offered a 3-year deal by an intermediary, but not an official representative of WCW made the offer. McMahon told others, and Diesel has also claimed to those in the dressing room, that they're offering him $750,000 a year, and most expect him to take it when his Titan contract expires in April.
And this coincides with his kind of... in between RC Tweener gimmick. Was this because they weren't sure where he was going to be, so they just kind of, fuck it, do what you want? Or?
I think they were moving him towards a heel. I think they realised at that point they knew we're getting the belt to Sean. Who does Sean wrestle? Diesel.
Sean afterwards. Okay, yeah.
We just talked about the situation with Diesel. Was there any situation at all with Razor Ramon?
It is believed that WCW has also made overtures about bringing in Razor Ramon, who was originally a strong WWF team player in the locker room, but his mood has changed with a shrinking paycheck, along with being unhappy with many aspects of how he's being used, specifically the feud with Goldust. This was, again, we mentioned this on the last show, he became Razor the Moan backstage because he was complaining about how much money he wasn't making in 95.
Yeah, but up until this point, he had a rep as being a good locker room
guy. A good locker room guy, until mid-95.
And at no point did he think to blame his buddy who was the champion.
Yeah. Diesel. Well, it's not the Click's fault.
Oh no, nothing's ever the Click's fault.
They kind of gave him the title back again at some point, the IC title, and he's lost it and so on. It just seems like he's kind of stuck in that kind of mid card. I'm wondering whether that also had something to do with it. They just seem to be like, you know, Diesel had his turn. Now it looks like Sean's getting his turn, and it's just like Razor Ramon, who I don't know. Would that? Would you think that play into it, that he just feels that like, hold a sec, when's my turn coming? I've been here a while now.
I don't think that's the case. It's
maybe
just
partly.
Maybe
particularly '95 when there was a chance for him to have like a main event run, not necessarily as champion, but be put up there as one of the top guys, and he never did.
I think it's got more to do with the fact that a sort of a mediator, if you like, offering this deal to Nash. Nash is well aware he's being offered a deal for less dates for more money, and Scott Hall's seeing that notion as well and thinking, I'm going to get more money. I've already started whinging about a reduced payload. You know, I think that's all it comes down to, really, at the end of the day. There may be some sort of side issues with the belt, perhaps, but at the end of the day, as we've seen from interviews with Hall afterwards and pretty much every shoot interview Nash has ever done, it's all about what the bank balance looks like.
Absolutely, and just to that point, before I throw it back to you, Chase, there is a note that comes out in the reserve, which I didn't include, but I'll mention it now. The payoffs for the pay-per-views at the end of '95 were coming in now, and they were in the hundreds as opposed to the thousands, and that was a big thing for a lot of the guys.
That's absolutely a fair point. I'm absolutely certain that at that time period that the primary thing on Razor Ramon's agenda was always going to be how much cash he was getting.
And let's just state for the record, we're talking guaranteed deals for them.
Yeah.
We're talking a guaranteed base rate of pay, which Vince still wasn't giving people.
He was about the opportunity.
There must have been, at this time, assurances towards him and towards Nash that when they arrive in WCW, they were going to be, you know, involved in a big angle, or at the very least, if they didn't have the NWA angle in mind, that those two are going to be used up in the main event scene. It must have been at least a deal sweetener for him, of just like he's knowing that he's going to be risen up at least a notch.
I think you're right, but you probably got it kind of the wrong way around. It's again WWF, when you know you're the land of opportunity, it's you're not going to make the money unless you're in that position at the top. Whereas if you're guaranteed the money, A, it doesn't really matter because you're guaranteed the money, and B, they're more likely to push you because of what they're paying you.
And so that was Pillman's entire game. He wanted to let the whole thing with Pillman, so he was trying to play both sides into the middle so that he could get a big contract in WCW, because his belief was they'll push you based on what they pay you. It's interesting because we're talking about Hall's pay. He made 400 grand in 94 and 250 grand in 95. WCW, I believe, offered him a guaranteed deal of 450. I might be a little bit off on the figure, but I'm pretty sure that's accurate. So again, from Hall's perspective, he's seeing, I'm getting an extra 200 grand to work less, sign me up. More than anything else, I think, there, maybe. Pillman was officially, or at least very publicly, fired by WCW on Thursday the 15th of February, although there are claims he's still on the payroll, as there are indications that the company is going to great and even laughable lengths to try and convince everyone that it's a shoot. So Meltzer has clocked onto the fact now that it's a work, and it is what it is. They give him the termination notice at Pillman's suggestion, written by the legal department, that is legally binding, but he's only using it as a prop, wink wink. WWF In Your House 6, February 18th, just a notable show here again. We've got Michaels against Owen Hart and Bret and Diesel in the main event cage match. 185,000 buys, very good buy rate for an In Your House. And Bret Hart once again gets treated like a jobber on this pay-per-view as world champion.
Oh, well, that's it. I suppose you've got the pull of the steel cage match from the buy rate perspective. But yeah, the treatment of Bret Hart is very much an afterthought, and the focus of that match is so much more on the fact that Undertaker comes from under the ring and drags Diesel down.
Yeah, and again, this is coming from the Royal Rumble where Diesel saved Bret's ass by costing Taker.
It's at this point, it's just becoming so obvious, at least for me, in retrospect, watching these tapes, that the obvious business shift is heading towards Shawn Michaels now, and it's just like Bret's just. He's just a retainer at the moment. He's just holding the belt ready for Shawn to take it from him.
Absolutely.
So why would they book him strong?
Champion.
I know that's what they should do, but it's just, probably Vince's screwed mind because he's too busy, you know, writing funny vignettes.
The uncensored card has undergone several changes. The main event is billed as a doomsday match with Hulk Hogan against four men in four different cages. Lex Luger replaces the Loch Ness Monster, joining Arn Anderson, Kevin Sullivan and Ric Flair all to face Hogan. We'll get into the doomsday cage match itself later because there are more changes to come. It looks like WCW is going back to the house show business after doing $216,000 on three weekend dates, all headlined by Flair versus Savage. The figures are doubly impressive because neither Hogan nor the Road Warriors were on the shows, and because the WWF had just run Baltimore and only drew 5,900, and WCW drew 11,000 in the same arena.
Oh, that's pretty interesting. Remind me, when did WCW stop doing
some point in 95 shows? I think it was late 94 or early 95, because they couldn't draw on the house shows without Hogan there, and it was just, what's the point? This is a money losing operation if we run these house shows.
It's just this byproduct. I mean, like, even though, you know, all the figures that we're given right now are, but it's kind of like, maybe this is the type of figures that were given Bischoff validation in what his booking style was. He's putting all his soul energy into Nitro, and they're kind of slowly but surely reaping the benefits by pay-per-view figures going up and now house show figures going up, so they can actually start doing house shows again. So it seems like at the moment his philosophy on booking, even though how abstract it is on the short term at the moment paying off.
Credit needs to go as well to Zane Bresloff, who had been scooped up by Bischoff and was a rock and roll promoter. He was the guy who promoted WrestleMania 3. But he did a lot of different things. He did on sale dates, things like that WCW hadn't done before. A lot of aggressive local promotion for these house shows, and it was paying off here.
If I'm not mistaken, you can correct me here, Liam, but I think we've mentioned this on a previous podcast, the house show business with Savage and Flair is the sort of, I was almost going to say the green shoots of recovery, if you like, but it's the real pickup in business for WCW.
It's the first real business indicator that was above the norm to some degree, other than the ratings, I think.
It's a good, I really enjoyed the feud as well, the Flair Savage.
Oh,
stuff.
Flair's awesome.
Flair is absolutely immense. But again, it's like that, you know, he's just, I just wish he was the focus of the company doing that stuff. But he was like classic Ric Flair, but apart from the short hair, which is again, no, not my personal choice, but he was fantastic. You know, when he's got with Liz and Woman there, he's just looking the absolute biggest douche in the world.
Was the episode when he comes, but they wheel him out on the stretch after he's been partying all night long?
But that was it's that nice little twist, isn't it? Of you've got the Liz heel turn, which you never would have seen in the WWF.
Yeah,
Vince would
yeah.
never have allowed that to happen. I'm not entirely shocked by the figures for Baltimore, in the sense that WCW did have an affinity in that area. If you think back to the bashes historically,
yeah,
you know, it's quite a jump from the WWF's number. But I'm not shocked that if they're going to do good business somewhere, it would be an area like that.
Raw on February 19th. After a false start in December, Titan Sports once again unleashed the Ultimate Warrior's return with a promo piece on Monday Night Raw. So he is actually coming in. Testosterone patch be damned. I don't know what you want to say about the whole goal of Vince to complain about the steroids a couple of weeks earlier and signing him anyway.
Loose ethics and loose morals.
Raw wins the night 2.9 to 2.7. Not much of a review on Nitro. Meltzer says it was probably the worst one since the beginning. The Booty Man debuted. So I think that pretty much sums that up.
Was that the one when Hogan put him over? What a great baby face he was.
The booty, yeah. Booty, booty man.
Who's the saviour, brother?
That's the one. And it's bad, bad stuff. Vader signed his 2-year contract within the past week or so. Bischoff on this Nitro did bring up Vader, saying he ran away with his tail between his legs after Paul Orndorff got through with him. Eric Bischoff on the same show announced that they were doing a cruiserweight title tournament on two continents, mentioned Brad Armstrong, Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero, Johnny B. Badd, Dean Malenko and Shinjiro Otani as the feature stars. He also mentioned making a deal with Antonio Peña from AAA and to expect the top stars from Mexico, which would in fact play out eventually.
Were any of those matches held in Brazil?
No, not in Rio de Janeiro. Wasn't that a one match tournament? As it turned out in the end, it's Benoit and Otani and that was it. Fucking hell. Rio de Janeiro might be better, actually. In a situation spoken of with some disdain by Vince McMahon, Scott Hall sent a telegram, that takes you back, on February 21st, officially giving his 90-day notice that he was leaving the company. On the same day, Hall was suspended from the company for 6 weeks for failing a drug test.
Mighty convenient that timing, isn't it?
And that was actually mentioned to Vince McMahon on I think, an online chat. And Vince said, well, if you don't get suspended, don't fail. A gay rights group got a major story in the Stanford Advocate critical of the Goldust character. They were mad at the message of portraying gay people as predatory homosexuals who are after and threatening straight men and glorifying the straight men beating them up. The WWF in the article said they've received a lot of response to Goldust, mainly negative, but have no plans to change the portrayal of the character. So all of Vince McMahon's comments on commentary here are getting a bit of a stir.
Yeah, they're absolutely right as well. And I mean, it didn't get any better. And I'm not just talking about the Goldust character. I mean, any sort of character that had some sort of homosexual agenda to them. I don't know. I've always been, at best, usually depicted as heels. Yeah. You know, the bad guys. Oh, those evil queers are going after the men again. You know, it's just they just never had any moment where they've done a positive gay character.
Well, you know why that is.
What's that?
Queering doesn't make the world go around.
Give it a couple of months, you might hear that on TV here. Especially with the feud that they went with. Note here from the Observer, several wrestlers who weren't being booked have pretty much been let go, amongst them Mo and Mabel. And I know that brings a tear to the eye of all of us.
Don't go, Mo.
Don't go, Mo.
Sir Mo, was it?
Just keep that.
Give me some Mo, yeah.
Give me some Mo. Just keep that note in mind, because there's a funny thing later on about that. But on March 5th, Kevin Nash officially gives notice that he will be leaving the WWF to accept an offer from WCW and a phone call to Vince McMahon. Hulk Hogan, who is still earning tons more than anyone else in wrestling, has apparently been vocal about the newcomers being paid too much and felt the money would have been better spent on Yokozuna or the Ultimate Warrior. I wonder why.
So is it at the point Hogan's deal something like 25% of the pay-per-view profits?
Yeah, 25% of the pay-per-view gross, or if it did less than, if that 25% was less than 300 grand, he'd get the 300 grand. March 15th, Johnny B. Badd quits World Championship Wrestling after an airport discussion with Eric Bischoff prior to the scheduled Monday Nitro appearance, and is expected to sign a 3-year deal with the WWF imminently. So we've seen a lot of movement here on both sides.
I wonder if the conversation was, hey Mark, why don't you bring your wife to the gym?
You know, there's a club that you guys should come to.
Just as a sign. Oh, the Gold Club.
All these years later and it's still funny.
Oh, warms the cockles of my heart. Is this not the first guaranteed deal that Vince gives?
I'm not sure if it's him or Pillman, but it's one of them. I know Bad gets a really good deal. Part I think might be Bad, actually.
Yeah. At that point, when as we mentioned, I think we actually skirted past this quite quickly when you were talking about the Mankind vignette starting as well. I mean, Mick didn't really get any kind of real decent deal, did he? He just kind of got pretty much
he got the opportunity deal.
He just got the opportunity deal. So yeah, it must have been Mero that got the first one.
And it's more evidence of Vince's genuine concern now and realization that he is in an actual war.
Yeah,
the fact that he is now willing to break from philosophy and give guaranteed money to wrestlers.
In addition, the Nasty Boys, who were let go last week by WCW in a measure to bring salaries under control, were also strongly rumoured to be WWF bound. Although after a meeting on Tuesday with Bischoff, they were talked into staying, unfortunately. I don't know why.
Contracts twice the size of their previous ones.
Yeah. This is great. Contracts are going out of control. We need to drop sags and knobs.
Yeah. Right away. On March 11th Nitro, Brian Pillman comes out with two large banners in the crowd that read, "Call Brian 1-900-288-PILL. Bischoff is still trying to work everyone on this angle, as he went so nuts behind the scenes that several employees actually believed he was mad about Pillman interrupting the show. This is just great stuff. Pillman has made his ECW appearance by this point as well, so he's just all over the shop.
Had he wrestled the pencil at this point?
No, not just yet. That was to come. The Steiner brothers returned on this Nitro as well and gave the Road Warriors a match 10 times better than anything they'd done since coming back. News to you, I'm sure, Carl. But again, and this was the reason why they wanted to can the Nasties, because they were placing, in essence, the Nasties with the Steins, which were big money deals.
Much better deal there.
During this episode of Nitro, a fan had a Hogan is Satan towel. Awesome.
And smart marks everywhere rejoice.
WCW did a marketing survey this week and found out that of all the wrestlers in WCW, the wrestler with the highest likability quotient was Eddie Guerrero. They were surprised at how disliked Hulk Hogan was and how Sting fared well, but not nearly as well as people figured he would.
He's been underused for the last, like, what, several months or so, and he's been lounging in, like, the freaking tag division.
Maybe they did the survey in Mexico or something, I don't know. Interesting thing here, on the March 11th of Raw, in the dark match, a newcomer named either Craig Johnson or Dwayne Johnson Johnson got a pin over the Brooklyn Brawler. Not sure who the guy is, but it was a tryout match and he looked green, but okay. Also on this Raw, the Ringmaster changed his name to Stone Cold Steve Austin. Yeah, and we're starting to see bits and pieces of himself coming out too in this character.
Yeah, Vince had already started, was starting to, call him, we've seen him as the Ringmaster, and Ted DiBiase went out his way to find this guy, and but he's certainly a stone cold individual, and he's saying this over and over again, literally 3-4 times per match every week for Steve Austin at this point.
Was DiBiase still doing the talking for him by this point, or had he started doing the whole kind of slow
monotonous
talking?
He was doing the slow monotonous stuff, but DiBiase was still with him.
Yeah.
Hogan, who has full control of his own programs and is basically the company head booker, decided that due to heavy influencing from Savage to again change the main event of the Uncensored pay-per-view from a 1-on-4 to 2-on-8. Four-decker cage match with rules that still haven't been explained or decided. Hogan released this information to the company midweek that he was adding Savage and four oversized heels to the mix, three of whom were Zeus, the Final Solution, Ultimate Solution, and the One Man Gang. The final spot will either be taken by Shark or Warlord.
Jesus. Oh my lord.
So in addition, after apparently being not clued in on this entire Brian Pillman situation, after Pillman's cameo on Nitro in the crowd with the banners, and seeing what a big reaction Pillman got, he immediately ordered Pillman to return and get involved in him in the Doomsday cage match, rather than milk the angle as originally planned. Pillman, in response, booked in a throat surgery for himself right before Uncensored so that he couldn't do the show. Awesome.
What a man.
Too fucking smart.
He had the surgery, a legit surgery, but he wasn't going to be played for a fall.
No.
The March 18th Nitro scored a huge ratings win with a 3.6, its best head-to-head rating ever, to Raw's 2.9, especially notable because we're only 2 weeks away from WrestleMania.
And it's an increasing sign there of a sort of groundswell of eyeballs on the company. We mentioned there, whenever Nitro previously had broken a 3 rating or Raw had done the same, you were looking at the other company having a number somewhere in the region of the mid-2s, possibly low-2s. Whereas there, I think that's probably the first sign that both are... One has broken through the 3 barrier and the other is quite close to it as well.
Uncensored. That's really all that needs to be said. March 24th, the Doomsday Cage match, one of the worst matches in the history of pay-per-view. This did 0.7 on pay-per-view, 167,000 buys up from Super Bowl, so the numbers are still going up for WCW here. Just a shocking pay-per-view, following in the footsteps of last year's dreadful Uncensored the year before.
And those that would follow on.
The Doomsday Cage match has to be discussed, because that is one of the worst matches I've ever seen on pay-per-view. It's like guys working in a battle royal where they do nothing, but they're actually, everyone's watching everything, as opposed to all kind of blending in together. It's like everything's being seen. Hogan is throwing punches that Sid Vicious would laugh at in that match. Zeus and the Final Solution. Oh, no, the Ultimate Solution.
No. Not Zeus. Z Gangster.
I forgot.
Z Gangster.
And the Ultimate Solution. My mistake. Again, and they got in there and did absolutely nothing. And of all people, Ric Flair got beat.
Same shit, different day. Even if the actual Zeus had turned up throwing thunderbolts, I don't think it could have saved that cage match.
It was terrible. They didn't even know the rules. At one point, Hogan says, "Let's get out of here." And him and Savage run off out of the cage to end the match. And then Savage turns around and says he's going to pin Flair. And does, and that's it.
Well, at least they were on the same page as the audience, because no one there had a fucking clue what was going on.
They were silent. They were deathly silent for the vast majority of that match.
Well, that was an improvement for Hogan in retrospect, when you consider the booze he's been getting around the country up to that point.
He's probably happy to have that. We're getting some feedback here. Bite off on the wrestling forum. Even though wrestling was better a few years later, 95 to 97 is actually the peak of my fandom. I was so into everything and I was obsessed. I was more of a WWF guy and my WCW hatred seemed to increase with each passing week. I had a staunch anybody but Michaels stance at the time. He was my least favourite wrestler in the company, though even back then I realised he was also the best guy in the ring. The Diesel Bret Taker stuff was fine. I hated Ahmed Johnson because I was convinced he was going to be the next Hogan Warrior, and they were my least favourite wrestlers of all time. Kid started off the year hot, but was dead to me after losing the Crybaby match in your house, which we didn't mention, but that was fucking awful. I did not want Jake, Warrior and Piper in my beloved WWF. This is the new generation, you geezers. Take your grey hair, flabby guts and 80s-ness to WCW where it belongs. Thank you, good day. Covering WCW, I hated Hogan and most of the 1989 WWF Geezer crew. DDP was the worst, except for maybe the Booty Man, or Duggan, or Public Enemy, or the Nasty Boys, or the Dungeon of Doom, or the American Males, or the most boring man on television, Fit Finlay. Man, that's a lot of suckage. Uncensored is the worst pay-per-view I ever saw. Giant vs. Loch Ness is...
What argue with that?
Giant vs. Loch Ness is seriously my favourite match from that mess.
Oh my god.
Main Event is the worst match of all time, and like three other matches on that show would have been solid worst match of the year contenders in most of the years.
I'm going to go back to these talking about the Vader stuff at the start. It's interesting because watching it back, Vader does feel out of place for me.
In a good way or a bad way?
In a bad way. It's in a way where I can... I think... and I, not for his fault, just I think his... You look at these, the cartoon over-the-top characters, and then in comes this guy, and he's, you know, he's throwing up the biceps, and he's a flabby fat fuck, and he's a badass, and he just it seems a little out of place. And when Vince is talking about him on commentary, I get the opinion that, yeah, Vince, straight away, it's...
Vince doesn't buy him,
yeah,
personally.
Maybe he doesn't buy him, maybe it's the look, maybe it's because he's not his guy, but it was a tangible feeling that he wasn't one of his guys, and he wasn't, yeah, he wasn't fully behind him. Just watching back, and you know, all the expectations and the way it turned out for Vader, you can see the writing on the wall pretty early when you watch back those his segments. I think
that is actually, when you say it like that, it does kind of come across like that way, because when you think about like all the other WCW guys that they brought in, like we mentioned before with Austin and Mick Foley being completely repackaged,
Vader wasn't
literally the same guy who was, you know, what, losing to Hogan the year before?
Yeah.
Same gimmick.
March 25th, we're back head-to-head after Uncensored. The Giant versus Ric Flair headlines. The Giant turns babyface on the Dungeon of Doom here, chokeslamming Kevin Sullivan after the match ends up with a schmarz. There's no Hulk Hogan on this Nitro, but it still does a 3.1 against Raw's 2.8. It wins. Notable, because this is the go-home Raw for WrestleMania, and they still lost to a Nitro that had no Hogan. Shawn Michaels versus Leif Cassidy with Brown commentary is on this show, and Owen and Ahmed is in the main event.
This is the beginning of bordering on 20 years of back and forth for the Giant in terms of being babyface and heel. This is the very beginning of just like turning heel or babyface every year, as it seems.
We'll get to that. The Road Warriors give notice on March 29th, but everybody kissed and made up by April 1st. Supposedly the problem was over what they heard Ramon and Diesel were going to get as compared to what they knew they were getting. So it's a bit of sour grapes there from Hawk and Animal, but all would be worked out. Which brings us to WrestleMania 12 on March 31st. 300,000 buys, 1.2 buy rate, a better buy rate than the Rumble, but not appreciably so. Apparently the original plan was for Bret and Michaels to be tied at 2 falls apiece and go into overtime. It was then switched to 1 fall and then eventually to 0 falls.
Was it neither guy wanted to give up the first fall? Because that's like they've won the real match. That's always been my psychology of like Iron Man matches. It's like the typical, you know, unless you've got shenanigans, babyface goes over first because it's like he wins the proper match, and you sit at that table and then you tell the story from then. Obviously with the two faces, obviously we know the tension between Bret and Shawn, and it's like they didn't, I don't know, did they not want to give just the pop away, or it was a bad move either way.
It was a bad move, and I think that I always thought that if they wanted that kind of built-in controversy to the, they might as well have just done 2-2 overtime and had Bret win the first four, and then you got the built-in controversy anyway, where we could just have Bret say, if this was a straight match, I'd have won, I'd have retained the belt.
But with it being an Iron Man match, you don't even need someone to be pinned or submit.
Yeah.
You can do a count-out, you can do a DQ. There are ways around it where everyone could have saved face. Nothing sticks out particularly to me in sort of the wider context of the Monday Night Wars. I remember it as a very bland Mania, in truth.
Very average. Yeah.
I wasn't a particular... It's not that the Iron Man match is a bad match, but it's been eulogised far beyond its actual relevance.
It's a bit of both, I think. I think the people that hate it too much, and the people that love it too much.
Yeah, that's probably fair. The only sort of notable sign for me, I would think, in terms of the war itself, would be the fact that, obviously, Taker goes clean as a whistle over Diesel, who's on his way out the door.
There was some decent enough stuff on the card, just kind of briefly. Just, you know, the brawl between Goldust and Piper, I thought was entertaining enough.
James and Goldust in women's underwear.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was,
and
just
and the
like,
use of the O.J. Simpson car.
Yeah, that's brutal.
That's just amazing, just for the fact they used that.
you know, Diesel Undertaker was passable considering the situation both of them were in at the time. But my main issue is with the Iron Man. And I think you're right, it's definitely one of those matches that has been overhyped over the years. Doing the Iron Match stipulation, why didn't you just have a normal title match and then it just ended up being an hour long?
A 1 hour draw.
Yeah, 1 hour draw. It's just...
And then they have to go to overtime, and that's the controversy.
That's why I hated it. So I wish they'd went with a 2-2. And I think, you know, have Brett win to begin with. You know, Brett, then Shawn, you know, and just... It's very simple. I just really hated... It's always bugged me about that match. The work rate in the match is fantastic. You know, you can't fault those two athletes. But the story of the match and just the nil-nil, it's never sat well with me.
Yeah, I was massively disappointed with the match.
Yeah, hugely.
Yeah, I mean, again, maybe it's just, you know, the result of how it's pushed. And, you know, the idea behind it, booking aside how it went down, the idea of putting those, you know, those two amazing workers in an hour, it's going to be guaranteed an hour, then you know, it's going to be something special. But then the nil-nil booking of it, and it's like completely negates that, and you just seem like one long Randy Orton chin lock or armbar really for an hour. So it didn't do it to me.
Can I just ask the rest of you in that regard, am I sort of alone in the sense that I don't see anything significant from this Mania in the context of the war?
No, totally. I mean, it's just a continuation. It's just crowning of Shawn on top. So they're going in the new generation direction still, with opposite the old guys in WCW. But now, in terms of, apart from, you know, the contractual situation, Razor and Diesel, as you say, it's really, it was almost a show predating the war, really. It was kind of, yeah.
The only thing I can think of is the fact that Brett left after this.
Yeah.
And that was like, which is why when I mentioned earlier about 96 and like the rosters and so on, like, you know, obviously not having Diesel or Ramon around, but also no Brett being around was a real bad call on that
real
show. However that came about, it was just really bad for Vince to not have Brett around that time, because it meant he really had to put, you know, everything into the one basket of Shawn Michaels. He didn't have Bret Hart as his backup like he has done for the last 2-3 years.
We're going to get some more feedback here. Fanny Pack from the UK Fan Forum. As an 8-year-old, I watched Raw at my cousin's house every Wednesday. I was waning as a fan for Mania 12, but the Warriors' return brought them a few months' time, and then when he bailed, I didn't watch wrestling again until September 98. The high point for me was the Warriors' return at Mania, and Razor putting the nappy on the 1-2-3 kid in your house. I loved that as a kid. The low point was how I didn't have a hero outside of that little Warrior run. I loved Razor, but he was never the champion and never had championship matches. I was never a Brett fan as a kid. Taker scared me, and I wasn't buying Shawn as a babyface after the barbershop. It all seemed a million miles away from the Hogan era, which I desperately craved. If only there was a wrestling show with Hogan and company for me to watch at the time. Stupid 8-year-old me. That's unfortunate. Actually, it should be noted here that we didn't actually get Nitro on TNT until March. So a lot of what he's saying there is actually echoed by that. It was available on DSF, but it's on a big delay.
Though I was an avid WWF fan back in the late 80s, early 90s, I got to say, by about 96, probably even 95, I would have switched to WCW by this point, and I would have been a WCW faithful. Just for the obvious fact that Macho Man was there, he was champion, that's an obvious one. But the fact that everybody I knew as a kid, like the chap here was saying about, like, everybody he knew from like the Hogan area is now in WCW, and like it's all the people who were essentially mid-card guys are now the main eventers in WWF.
We mentioned on one of our previous podcasts was about the use of Savage. Could he have been like the Raw, almost Stone Cold gimmick? And this is the time when they really should have done it, when he was, you know, a bit out of control,
he lost
his mind,
alimony situation with Liz.
If they'd have gone full ball, I mean, it's probably because of it, the whole industry hadn't progressed at that point then, but instead he just came out wearing his same gear, yet it was black and white at times, but it was still, you know, the same caricature Savage. I just wonder if they'd gone full ball and maybe dropped the tassels and made him edgier, probably shaved his head so he didn't look bald, he's just a buzz cut. I know it's going down the Steve Austin route, but could they have, you know, could he have popped himself? for something, do you think? Or?
But the asterisk here, no matter what, when it comes to Savage, is that Hogan's there, and Hogan's going to do what Hogan wants. Yeah. And in his mind, Savage is number two to him. And no matter what Savage does, no matter what colour he's wearing, no matter how much hair he does or doesn't have, and if Hogan's the guy.
And I'm sure if Savage, that started to work, it would have been dropped, Hogan would have done the same thing.
Yeah, himself. Cage, brother.
Exactly. Big Bad Mick from Pro Wrestling Only. I wasn't watching either group at the time, but I've given Raw's the good look through ever since. The good is bringing in Mankind, Austin, Mero, Goldust, and Vader. They weren't all necessarily immediate hits, but over time they found useful spots on the roster and contributed something positive, to say the very least. The build to Bret and Shawn was great, but it was the biggest match they had, and by God did they let you know about it beforehand. The bad is Billionaire Ted, the Warrior. Every last moment on screen was horrible or else went nowhere, and Ahmed Johnson, he wasn't very good in the ring. Which, actually, the worst of Ahmed was yet to come. I thought he was quite promising at this point, as a matter of fact, as a youngster. Demo Time 2 from the Wrestling Forum. It's hard to remember how I felt at the time, being 10 years old, but I definitely remember more Nitro stuff than Raw, and I just recently rewatched this whole year, and I can definitely see why. The build-up to HBK and Bret was good, no doubt, and the Diesel Taker feud was executed perfectly. Things are so much easier to book when you know one guy is about to leave, as is the case in both of them. Everything else was awful. WrestleMania 12 was terrible, probably the second worst I've rewatched so far. The mid-card, while filled with talent, has absolutely no direction, and you're not getting a real sense of who McMahon sees money in. Post-WrestleMania, Raw is even worse. Now that Bret is taking a break, you can tell that McMahon has no idea what to do. He has one plan. Boobs. And lots of them. If you notice, Mero, Goldust, and the Smoking Guns get 90% of the airtime, and it's painfully obvious why. Curious little take there that I actually didn't think about. Crazy Jim Films from the Wrestling Forum. I was a huge WWF fan, and the start of the year actually seemed promising. The build-up to the Rumble was one of the better ones. I loved Diesel and Shawn at the time, and the debut of Vader and Return of Jake were both interesting to me. Didn't care much for Nitro, but the Miss Elizabeth turn seemed interesting. I would try to catch reruns of Nitro when I could, but Raw was my preferred home. I thought the booking for Mania 12 felt very rushed. It seemed like the other matches got shortchanged because Shawn and Bret were going the hour. The drama of Diesel and Taker was kind of lost when it was clear Nash was on the way out. Post-WrestleMania, I thought Sunny and Sable being around was very nice. I was a teenage boy at the time, and wrestling really hadn't offered anything like that since Missy Hyatt left WCW. I also loved that Mick Foley was joining the WWF as Mankind. His two different themes at the start and end of the match were very unique, and I liked how crazy the character was. And wrapping up this part of the feedback, Crikey from the UK fan forum. I was so engrossed in the HBK title chase at the time and his title run afterwards. It's why it remains one of my favourite periods in wrestling. The 12-year-old in me thought the Iron Man match was the greatest match ever. I loved it at the time. Apart from a Rumble, I'd never seen a match go that long, and Pro Wrestling Illustrated hyped it up as the greatest match of all time too, and I took everything in the apt mags as gospel back then.
Interesting point made by, I think it was Crazy Jim there.
I love usernames.
Yeah. There was this kind of like this positive spin towards female managers all of a sudden, as opposed to the male managers. You still had Paul Bearer, I believe, and Cornette, but now you're getting in Sable, Sonny in particular,
Marlena
as well. And it's just like, yeah, I've never actually kind of like put two and two together with that. It was the fact that there was becoming a more sudden sexualized female presence on the show with these three, and in particular with Sonny. I mean, she was quite the flaunter,
quite the slice at the time.
Yeah, that's a great term.
She was
quite the slice.
She was everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah, like spot on. That was the mid card. Was those three women?
Was Sonny the first, and Sonny then she got first, over. Yeah. So
then Sable and Marlena came after that because Sonny was a hit.
Yeah.
The day after WrestleMania, here we go. They open with Mankind, who got no reaction except for a few ECW fans in the front row chanting "He's hardcore" as he beat Bob Holly. However, he then attacked The Undertaker and left him laying after his match. Mark Mero also debuts on the show, pinning Isaac Yankum. Shawn Michaels did an interview. He got a good reaction, but not as good as you'd think. Taker and The Ultimate Warrior both got much bigger pops live than Michaels. Off camera, Shawn appeared to lose it because he started saying "fuck you" and "blow me" to the fans that were booing him. There were a lot of negative posters regarding Michaels from Bret Hart fans, and it was described that Titan officials were almost violently confiscating them. So this is there've been traces of Shawn kind of losing his marbles, not maybe being mature enough for the spot at this point.
You could tell.
But there's more to come, but that was the night after he wins the belt, so there you go. On Nitro, the Giant, who had just turned face 7 days earlier, was turned back heel again. Hogan and Booty Man beat Anderson and Sullivan. The Cleveland fans booed Hogan out the building, and talk once again surfaced to turn him heel, which didn't happen. But there you go. So Giant, you were mentioned before. That's really set the pace for the Giant's turns in his career.
Absolutely, and I'm not
one week.
I'm not absolutely certain, but I don't think that's the only turn that's going to happen this year as well.
Probably not. No. This was the day after WrestleMania. The WWF did win the night, 2.9 to 2.8. So very, very close. But again, the numbers are kind of rising on both sides here, very, very slowly. April 8th. The WWF shattered a record doing a 4.7 unopposed, which featured the television return of The Ultimate Warrior, Shawn Michaels versus Jerry Lawler, and Vader versus Yokozuna, where Vader breaks Yoko's leg, which is the other moment I was referring to earlier on, which is a hell of an angle because they really dragged it out. They really took their time with Vader getting... They couldn't put a Yoko on a stretch, had to put him on a forklift. This is a good boost for Vader here, one of very few shining moments. 1 week later, Brian Pillman was thrown 40 feet out of his open-air military vehicle while he was driving, and at press time is hospitalised in Cincinnati. So Pillman's whole idea of playing every side against the middle and doing a lot of dangerous things to try and get this character over the top kind of backfires on him, and he unfortunately wrecks his Humvee and still manages to get a great deal out of it.
Where was he contractually at this point then?
He was free to negotiate with anyone because the WCW had given that termination notice. It's amazing how this didn't even hurt his market value because both sides still bid huge for Pillman. So it's amazing what a wrestling war will do.
It's a tricky time period because I mean this is like essentially like the beginning of
the end,
the kind of end for Pillman after such great early moments for him in the Loose Cannon role. It is actually quite amazing that he got as good a deal as he did considering the severity of the car crash and the fact that it was a long time. The recovery period was quite long as well, wasn't it, for something for his injuries. And
they didn't know that at the time. Pillman told him it would only be 3 months.
Yeah, I'm sure he did.
And by the time we get to the King of the Ring in June, he's there on crutches still.
Yeah. But the April 15th Nitro is more noteworthy for the controversy behind the scenes than in front. Hogan sent word that he had a movie deal that would take him out of action until August. The plans were made for him to do an injury angle and to be written out of all plans. Anyway, Hogan changed his mind at the 11th hour once again, and not only decided against the injury angle, but instead not only won a handicap match on the show, but popped up from the Giant's chokeslam, slammed him, and then ran him off as well. So the insecurity of Hogan here is just obvious for all to see.
What can you say? What can you say?
I think I need some time off. Now I've changed my mind. I'm going to punch God instead.
What I need is to go over more. There is talk of Nitro going to 2 hours every Monday night. The idea behind it is that TNT would increase its weekly payment to WCW for the second hour, which would make WCW even more profitable, and with the added money they can acquire even more talent. Even if 2 hours is overexposure from a wrestling standpoint... That's 2 hours overexposure. From a TNT standpoint, an hour of Nitro would do double the ratings. So very interesting note there, because that would come into effect.
Well, yeah, this is a very important part in the Monday Night Wars, and you know, specifically for, you know, Thunder in Paradise stopping. But yeah, the 2 hours, I mean, that kind of changed everything. I mean, this is Bischoff getting cocky and confident, really almost inappropriately too soon. You know, he's had a few good runs here and there. It was important for the fact of what he had to do in order to fill that second hour, which is like he continues to bring people in. And I think it's because of this 2 hours that you now start to see probably more in the news articles, more emphasis on the cruiserweights, and they start bringing in the luchadors and so on, just to try and fill that extra hour. Yeah.
Well, and as you said as well, when they went unopposed, they did like four. Yeah, I mean, you do that. In theory, do it every week, and hopefully we'll nick some of their audience as well. So it's completely understandable. We're getting paid for it. So.
This takes us to In Your House, April 28th. This is Good Friends, Better Enemies, one of my favourite pay-per-view names in company history. Yeah. Shawn versus Diesel in the main event, a 0.81 buy rate for 190,000 buys. So a very respectable, very good buy rate for an In Your House for Shawn as champ.
And Diesel's last
pay-per-view appearance.
Yeah. And the swan song for Ramon as well.
Yeah, Ramon gets beat by Vader. This has also got the fucking horrible Warrior Goldust match on, if anybody remembers that borscht.
I was just thinking about Shawn stealing Mad Dog Bashan's leg.
That was great stuff. The time slot change for Monday Nitro due to the NBA playoffs goes into effect and is going to leave WCW destroyed in the ratings battle until late May. Raw on the 29th of April, going live the day after a pay-per-view and unopposed, with the Ultimate Warrior versus Isaac Yankem in the main event. The WWF does a 3.9 rating, tying its second highest Raw mark in history. WCW, despite trying to get word out about having the world title change hands again on its show in a new time slot, only does a 2.1 at 7 p.m. Giant wins the WCW title from Ric Flair here in the main event. Again, it's that fear of losing any traction. They were going toe-to-toe. It was intense. And they were being bumped at a pretty crucial time because, again, WWF, it's not one-sided. It's very, very level here. They don't want to lose any traction. The hot shot again, we're seeing it. Again, the day after a pay-per-view, world title change. You notice in a pattern?
Is there any word on the reason why they gave it to Giant? Because it kind of seems like...
Because who do you think it was going to go to from there?
Okay. Okay, that does make sense.
On Raw, the same night, the 29th of April, Jim Cornette does an amazing interview and a great angle where they claim Shawn Michaels had propositioned Diana Smith the night before during the pay-per-view, and it wound up with Michaels and Davey in a very realistic-looking brawl.
Yeah.
What do you think to this? Because this is, as we'll see, I didn't like this decision at the time. I'd like it even less in retrospect, Davey Boy being a challenger for Shawn.
Yeah, that's like, as you said, coming
pivot!
Off, coming off Mania, as you say, like Brett and there's this, the roster's thinning. One redeeming feature of this feud probably was the serial pervert Jerry Lawler on commentary saying how despicable it is that Shawn Michaels is hitting onto married women. Hilarious.
Awesome. Expect WCW to fairly quickly go to Hogan versus Hall and Giant versus Nash before they go to the inevitable Giant Hogan for the title feud. So that answers your question.
Yeah, okay.
And it's official. World Championship Wrestling announces on May 8th that it is expanding Nitro to 2 hours, effective on May 27th. The decision to do so virtually came immediately as a response to the ratings on May 6th, where again in the 7 p.m. time slot, it did a 1.9 compared to Raw, which did a 4.1.
Whereas I'd mentioned earlier about sort of the groundswell of support for both companies and improving business sort of across the board, it still goes to show that an element of the viewing figures comes from viewing habits, if you like. You look at the numbers that Raw's doing in its regular time slot,
yeah,
and just how quickly the WCW numbers drop off just from moving it an hour, bringing it an hour forward. It shows that element of, from sort of all TV programs and that sort of perspective, you get into a habit of watching something at a particular time.
Yeah.
So it goes to show that while the sort of strength of the business is improving from the dark days of 93, 94 and 95, it's still not at that stage where it's the must-see television that you will get when the NWO later arrives and when you get through 97 and 98.
Thinking about the two complete different parallels with the companies at this time in terms of how they book in the champions with Bischoff just hot-shotting these titles around, these names, whether it's just to try and create buzz on the shows or whether it's to appease certain egos, whilst on the other hand, like Vince's, you know, he keeps the belt on Brett for, you know, 5 months, and then he gives it to Shawn, and Shawn has it through till Survivor Series and stuff.
Mentalities are obvious on
the TV. It's the different philosophies, as we've already said. Bischoff is very much about the ratings on a Tuesday morning, and Vince is still got a more traditional mindset of you build to pay-per-views, and you know, you have a more long-term
and money. Let's be honest,
that's still where your money is in pay-per-view buys, and you've also got sort of that working in conjunction with Vince's old mindset of, and even predating Vince and going back to his his father rather. It's the babyface company.
Yeah.
It's the company where the babyface has the title.
We should note here, on the May 13th episode of Raw, they heavily edited a Goldust Undertaker angle. Goldust licked the Undertaker as he was lying on the mat from his knee up to his groin. However, on the as a taped show, so they edited it so that he immediately changed the camera angle to make it not look so bad, and they jump cut to him sitting up once he got to the knee. It was still bad, but in the edited form, it was not nearly as bad as it was described by those who saw it live.
Was this the segment when Goldust was talking about how Undertaker's stiff rigor mortis or something?
And they'd done the scene where he sort of touches his hands and clasps with him, and it's all very unusual situation to see the Undertaker in.
Fair play to Dustin though, man.
He didn't give a fuck. He was going for it.
He's got balls, man. He's just going for this.
You could see him in that outfit as well.
Monday Night Raw does a 3.5 here, where Nitro again at 7 p.m. owned us a 2.3 for Giant versus Luger. The final appearances of Diesel and Razor in the WWF came in a strange curtain call finale of the Click. It was the Garden's second straight sellout, and that's the first time that's happened in 11 years. So again, big metrics here for the WWF, but Diesel and Razor, off the curtain call. I don't know if anybody wants to jump in on this. It's been talked about a lot.
Okay. I don't think we need to go too far in sort of through the weeds, if you like, of this one. But it's a sign that you can argue kayfabe was already dead. Enough people will point to Vince and not wanting to pay the tax in New Jersey and that sort of thing. But this is very much the crumbling of the fourth wall, almost, if you like.
Absolutely. We move on to Slamboree on May 19th. This is the Battle Bowl. Another WCW pay-per-view filled with negative feedback. DDP wins the Battle Bowl. It's headlined by Sting and the Giant, but it only did a 0.44 buy rate, 108,000 buys, so a drastic drop from Uncensored.
Yeah, the most intriguing thing about that Battle Bowl, if I remember, as you said, DDP wins it, and doesn't he win a title shot?
He's supposed to.
Yeah, because that brings the next question. Yeah. What happened to that title shot?
Well, he got a Battle Bowl ring, is that not enough?
Wasn't there a stipulation where his feet hit the... Didn't he have some shenanigans in the actual main event where he actually got eliminated and came back in, so they said, well, that takes away the title shot?
Yeah.
Hogan's not on the pay-per-view, which probably explains some of the drop, as much as that pains a lot of people to hear.
No, I think that's true. I think it's probably... Whereas we used the Rumble as an example earlier of the sort of the positive connotations the Rumble has and the eyeballs it will draw because it's the Rumble, the Battle Bowl is a is a poor concept and had never done well in previous years.
What's it about bowls in wrestling?
Well, yeah. Well, they're full of turds. But no, the Battle Bowl, since its inception, had never done well, and there's negative connotations attached to it, so I think that and Hogan just sort of creates the perfect shitstorm for the bowl.
they do an angle with Steve McMichael and Kevin Green on this show, however, to set up Great American Bash 1 month later. Yeah. 1 week later, in your house, beware of dog.
Oh, here we go.
Beware of dog shit, I suppose. a power outage led to the strangest pay-per-view show in history. Actually, it's on the 26th and the 28th of May, as it turns out. It's a complete catastrophe.
Yeah.
Huge issues in the main event as Shawn Michaels goes out there thinking that they're not on the air, and as a result kind of puts in a house show performance. When he finds out halfway through the match, he fucking loses his shit. Lots of bad stuff here. It did, again, we talked about Davey Boy and how I'm not a huge fan of Davey in this period of time, not necessarily for his work, but he wasn't the main event guy. He'd been recycled in and out. The buy rate almost cut in half from the previous In Your House 1 month before, 108,000 buys.
So, sorry, just confused.
And this is before refunds, by the way, which meant it was a disastrous show for the company.
Just to clarify, because I'm a bit vague on this. So how did this go down then? Because the lights went off during the Austin match, wasn't it?
No, Mero, Helmsley in the opener. After that match, the lights went out. They did the show live in the building. The rest of the matches are as advertised on the pay-per-view, but they just had the baby faces go over.
Yeah.
But
did they record it?
No. This was a blank screen, and it kept coming back to Vince McMahon every so often saying, please bear with us, folks. And then they came back in time, got the power on just in time for the main event, Michaels and Davey Boy, but they didn't tell them that they were on the air. They assumed, Michaels and Davey Boy, when they went in the ring, they were going to do a rematch on the second pay-per-view show that they ended up doing 2 days later fill in the blanks. Sean lost his shit with a fan in the front row, a woman who was heckling him,
I'm not going to get a debate with Shawn Michaels with the fan club here, so...
It's that thing where, I know Davey had the match in December with Brett, and he'd had the match in...
Which was the lowest drawing pay-per-view in company history.
And he'd had the match in October with Diesel.
Which was the second worst.
So there's already a pattern established there, but then you've got to look at what they were doing with Davey Boy prior to that. Mm. You know, I think he was Final Four in the Rumble, but he was never really hyped as someone who was a potential winner. I can't even remember if he wrestled on the February show. Liam, you might know.
He wrestled Yoko.
He wrestled Yoko.
Which was a setup for Vader to come out and beat the shit out of Yoko.
Yeah, so you've got a non-finish in that match. And then you get to WrestleMania... He's wrestling the six-man tag, the opener, and he's really... I don't want to say he's a non-entity, but he's just part of the furniture there. That's not a match that goes particularly long, if memory serves.
No.
And then the April show, I don't think he wrestles on the April show.
I think it's him and Owen against Ahmed and Jake.
So again, it, you know, a match with no story. There's no meat to the bone there. So
then all of a sudden,
you throw him in, and you can understand why the buy rate is what it is.
They had no one else. It's David. As soon as Bret Hart was gone, it's like it's reaping what you sow there, because it's like you let Bret, Diesel, and Razor Ramon go, and then as soon as they looked around and said, "Who have we got left?" It's Bulldog, Owen, Armored, is it Yoko?
I know what you're saying about Bret, but we can't really blame Vince for Diesel for Nash and Hall. They, you know, they left him up shit creek.
And they knew about all those guys well in advance, so there's no excuse for not prepping guys for Sean for his run. Just say what they did with Davey Boy. They had either no intention or no inclination to build anyone for Sean at that point. So.
Yeah, they knew that all three of those guys were leaving in February and we're at May and they've still got no other option but Bulldog. The Ted DiBiase stipulation on the second Beware of Dog came as he gave notice a few days earlier to the WWF that he would be leaving for WCW when his contract expired. He accepted a 3-year deal, but it was $750,000 over 3 years to work as an announcer and a manager, not to wrestle. Austin did not miss Ted DiBiase, I should say. That strap match is actually pretty good with Savio. Underrated little match, I feel. Austin and Savio.
It's been a long time since I saw it. I remember being shocked as a child at the time that Savio went over, though. I was convinced that Austin was going to go over.
Yeah.
Well, obviously not knowing that DiBiase was leaving, not being in tune in that sense, I was convinced Austin was going to go over Savio.
May 27th, Nitro. The first ever 2-hour Nitro telecast was almost a complete dud, with the exception of the debut of Scott Hall. Meltzer mentions here, playing off promotion versus promotion, particularly at a time when feelings of the fans regarding each promotion are so heated, is the best way to make money from these newcomers. And the longer they can keep the illusion going that they're outsiders, the more money they'll make from the angle. Aside from the Hall debut, this show is terrible.
Well, you only have to look at the match that's going on in the ring as Paul is making his way
through. The Mauler versus Steve Dahl.
Yeah.
And just to get, okay, Dallas Page versus Craig Pittman, The Giant versus Shark, Luger versus Max Muscle, Brad Armstrong versus Bobby Walker.
Who the fuck is Max Muscle?
He used to be DDP's bodyguard in 95.
Duh.
How do you not know that, Carl?
I completely
didn't you watch Worldwide?
I completely forgotten that, and the fact that Craig Pittman was still employed by the company.
Was it Pittman at one point? Didn't he? He was so desperate to progress his career. I think he went and spoke to Steve McMichael on commentary,
to be his manager,
to ask manager or trainer. Yeah. Like, okay.
I know. What's he going to teach you?
I don't know. How to keep a job, maybe.
How to do announcing horribly.
What was the numbers for that show?
We'll get to that very, very shortly. I just want to mention here, before we get to the numbers, it's a Sting-Scott Steiner main event, and it's a fuck finish. The note here, Bobby Heenan was fucking awful on commentary, calling Deborah McMichael Brenda McMichael. He called Sting Luger, and he didn't know if Sting and Steiner had ever wrestled each other before, when not only have they many times, but in recent weeks on Worldwide, in a match that Heenan did commentary on. So this might be during the drinking period of Bobby Heenan's career. With WCW debuting its 2-hour format, WWE's Live Raw did a 3.3 to Nitro's 2.8. So Raw still won with the Vader versus Ahmed Johnson main event. And again, speaking to the bad treatment of Vader, this is the match where Vader is beaten by Ahmed, except for the fact that Owen Hart helps him and Vader gets the pin. Also does lead to the great Goldust CPR angle with Ahmed, though.
Yeah, as I say, up to this point, yeah, when we talk about the Monday Night War, initially thinking, Austin, NWO. So now this, business is about to pick up, as we say. But up to this point, neither of these companies could have booked this angle better than the reality that's happened in the situation.
Exactly.
To get them to this point. Yeah. So they should both be grateful, but I don't think they were.
I just wonder if, and I don't know if you've got the breakdowns for the separate hours there.
Yeah, 2.7 for the first hour, 2.8 for the second, so pretty much dead heat.
I just wonder if, it going back to my suggestion there about viewing habits, if maybe that first hour number was quite low in comparison to the second hour.
And maybe dragged it down.
Yeah, I wonder if that may have been the case, but evidently not.
No, the Monday Night Raw taping opposite this Nitro, this is the one that beat the debut of Scott Hall. In the King of the Ring qualifier, Jake Roberts pinned Hunter Hearst Helmsley after a DDT, and Roberts put the snake on Triple H after the match. The result was almost certainly punishment for the incident in Madison Square Garden where Helmsley, Shawn, Diesel and Razor did the curtain call and violated kayfabe. Of course, this is after fucking billionaire Ted had revealed that Hogan had it in his contract that he couldn't lose, but never mind. The belief is Vader isn't getting over as the killer heel they'd hoped for.
Although
he does look to be the favourite to win King of the Ring, it's being blamed on his weight. Meltzer adds, you can't make a killer heel out of someone who isn't pushed to be a killer.
There's nothing to add to that. Absolutely nothing. Meltzer sums it up perfectly.
The Road Warriors officially quit WCW on May 28th. It was the same problem that had been going on for a few weeks, where they'd heard that Nash and Hall were getting far more and thought they should be in the same ballpark, and Bischoff thought otherwise. And so do I.
Were the Road Warriors really still a big draw?
I don't think. I mean, they
in
made
comparison to the 80s or early 90s.
No, not in comparison to the 80s, but at the same time, they had a little bit of ratings juice left. Maybe it's curiosity, but some of those early Nitros where they were on. Again, Road Warriors versus Sting and Luger beat Bret Taker.
Yeah, because it's just the thing, you know, that those Nitros may have been tricky. I mean, you know, their work on future Raws weren't particularly great either, but yet they always kind of deemed themselves that they still thought they were in like the 80s and that they were still like hot shit and so on. It's just like, you're done, guys, you know, you just kind of...
I think that's going a bit too far to say they're done. I think part of the issue is, not that I want to completely defend the Road Warriors, and the sort of their work during that 4 month stint speaks for itself, but they were never featured prominently during that stint. They were never in really any program of note. Yeah. So it's hard to say how much success they could have really had or how much impact they could have really had when they were really just, they were just there.
You know, that tag division, talent-wise, blows away WWF's smoking guns, but a bunch of guys, what did the Road Warriors do? They were just guys, really, when it's all said and done after that run. Yeah. So, and they just, WCW seemed to have a habit of doing that, and yeah, it's... Yeah.
Just to get some more feedback here, Heyman Disciple from the Wrestling Bomb. At the time, I was actually viewing both shows as I'd watch Raw live and tape the late night Nitro replay and watch it back the next morning. I was definitely more of a Raw guy, and it was May that it lost steam. Nash and Hall left. They were starting a lame feud with Shawn and the Bulldog over Diana Hart, but at the same time, Nitro launched a 2 hours and started the NWO angle that had me hyped as fuck. Nitro prior to May was also lame. Too much Hogan, the fucking booty man, and you didn't see nearly enough Benoit, Malenko, and Guerrero. It's actually quite interesting, we haven't really mentioned anything these guys have done this entire period, because they really did nothing.
Well, no, in the case of Benoit, I suppose, he suffers from the Pillman exit.
Yeah, for sure.
Very much so.
Although they do put him in the Sullivan angle.
They do eventually, but it's not. He didn't start straight into the Sullivan angle.
No. There was a couple of months lag there. C4 from the Wrestling Forum says, this was a very interesting time. I felt that this period, starting in January, was when the WWF went on a massive offensive after having absorbed the initial blows. The WWF, the Raw show began to show improvement in production values as the show benefited from a move back to slightly bigger venues. For me, the biggest factors in the WWF during this time were Goldust and the Ultimate Warrior. Both characters were precursors to the later Attitude Era, going back to what you said earlier, G. The Goldust character was an attention grabber and stood out like nothing before it. The Warrior came back as a character that could be seen in some respects as a prototypical version of Steve Austin. Do you remember actually they were having him swear on TV quite a lot, weren't they, when he came back?
No, he said ass a couple of times, but I don't really see the Steve Austin connection. I don't see any precursor to the Attitude Era with regards to the Ultimate Warrior.
Nitro, on the other hand, showed some of the issues that would hurt them years later. They had run out of big names to pop up on their shows for most of this period. Hall and Nash were signed, but they would not show up until near the end of May. The Warriors and the Steiners both came back to add additional star power, but there was a dearth of new single superstars making surprise appearances between January and May. Nitro felt like it was treading water up until that point, and the Giant is Champion, as well as the feud between Flair and Savage, did not seem especially compelling to me. So there you go, the other side of the coin there on the Flair-Savage feud.
Yeah, and with he mentions the sort of the bad habits of Nitro, if you like, which we've all talked about it at varying points during this podcast. The other one that we've also alluded to is the celebrity involvement, and when you think of, you know, their transition to Mongo and Kevin Green in wrestling matches,
yep,
something which we know would escalate over the next couple of years.
Absolutely. King Pitcast from the UK Fan Forum. For me, the highlight of this period was the Raw magazine. Such a departure from what the WWF magazine was, I was amazed. This time period was when I first started reading Power Slam as well, as their issue with a WrestleMania 12 coverage was a good month or two ahead of where the WWF magazine was up to, and about 3 years ahead of where Pro Wrestling Illustrated was up to. So this is the time period where I started getting into the backstage gossip. As for on-screen happenings, the outsiders have to be the main thing. I started watching WCW maybe a week or two before Razor turned up, and I was hooked on that story. Same for me, as a matter of fact. Looking at TNT's WCW Teletext page in the week for hints of what would be coming up on Nitro on Friday. That takes you back, remember that?
I do.
In the WWF, I was well into the Shawn Michaels story. I got a VCR for Christmas that year and cable in my room. I recorded the Tell Me a Lie video off Superstars and played it over and over. I never liked Bret Hart, so I was supporting Shawn all the way for WrestleMania.
Oh, fuck you.
Oh, how dare you. Chin him, Kieran.
Fuck you, Carl. That sentiment of the fuck you.
I've nothing against Shawn Michaels, but I just love Bret Hart.
On the June 3rd Raw, Vince McMahon, in what appeared to be a prepared lawyer's statement, said that Diesel and Razor Ramon were no longer part of the WWF, and that they intended to portray themselves as the stars they once were, participating in a ruse that they're still part of the WWF, but they're actually under contract to a rival organization. In addition, WWF sent a legal letter to Scott Hall, where it informed that Hall, they believed, was infringing on Titan's intellectual property by portraying the Razor character.
More importantly, as I say, it's the complete 180 on not only mentioning a rival company, but actually talking about the stars and what they're going to be doing and advertising WCW for them. It's desperate times, I guess.
Really bizarre. Yeah. Again, wrong moves from Vince here. Coming on the heels of the Scott Hall angle, WCW rebounded the next week with a 3.0 to Raw's 2.3. The hourly breakdown was 2.8 for the first hour and 3.2 for the second. So in a head-to-head battle, WCW won by nearly a full point. Scott Hall promised a big surprise next week. But again, these two-hour nitros have both sucked. And the depth on the roster and what they're doing, they're not putting the good wrestlers they've got in good positions.
It's like a work in progress with Bischoff all the time. It's fighting fires and dealing with situations with minimal long-term planning. At times created clusterfucks on screen on the same show, and over time, obviously, you know, for example, the terms of the big show, the giant as it was, just a bit of a mess. But it's the pressures of this, what Bischoff's putting on himself, really, for ratings, and just Bischoff's almost created this fight himself, and by God, he's got to keep it up now.
The latest chapter in the Truth is Stranger Than Fiction, and Truth Sometimes Is Fiction, saga of Brian Pillman came on June 6th when he signed a 3-year contract with the WWF. So there you go. In the end, Pillman goes with the WWF because they don't take the Bischoff doesn't want to take the 90-day injury cycles that got Steve Austin out of the contract, and because Pillman knew he was going to be gone for a long time, he took the guaranteed money, which I think was either $350,000 or $400,000 for the WWF. So gets a big increase in pay here.
That's not too far off from what Scott Hall was being offered.
Exactly.
It's not bad at all.
The June 9th Chicago House Show. There was a big story with Vader in The Ultimate Warrior. They had done 20-second squashes all weekend, somewhat because Vader had a bad hip, but more because Warrior's shoulder was messed up. I guess because the crowd was so big, or because Hellwig was unappreciative, or because the quick pins are getting a lot of press in Japan, Vader took the clotheslines and walked out of the ring. As he got to the back, the officials basically told him if he didn't go back, he might as well walk all the way back to Colorado and not come back. He got back in the ring, did the match, but ended up walking out again for a countout rather than taking the plan pin. Right now, as a result, there are no plans to push Vader until the fall, and they want him to drop weight first. So this is a story that hasn't got a lot of press before, but this is the incident that pulls King of the Ring from Vader, and they give it to Austin as a result. That's why.
I'm surprised, given we've talked about the lack of depth on the WWF side in terms of opponents for Sean, I'm surprised that Vince, given how he's clearly sort of flailing in the dark with many of his actions, it's surprising that he would be willing to risk that. You know, the roster is not what it needs to be in the first instance. I'm surprised he'd run the risk of letting Vader go.
But that's if at that by that point he even wanted him there on his roster, on his wage bill, because we said there was dissatisfaction with him early. They wanted him to lose weight. They allegedly wanted to push him later in the year.
True, but if you look at the fact that the Bulldog had served his notice as well, I mean, even if Vader's not going to WCW, you've still got the perception of Vader and Bulldog have left as well. It's the rats from the sinking ship image.
And that was an image that Vince was trying desperately to fight away, and that's why he brought back Warrior in the first place, was because he saw these guys go and he wanted to bring someone in the other direction. Again, all these guys like Pillman and Mero as well. The June 10th Nitro, the best of the two-hour Nitros to date, although that is faint praise considering the first two. Notable because Kevin Nash debuts as the second guy coming in here, along with Scott Hall. They announce that there is a third man, and Meltzer notes that it is Lex Luger that is the plan at this point. However, this Nitro loses to Raw, 2-7 to 2-6. Raw's main event was the British Bulldog against The Undertaker with a count-out finish, but Raw won the night.
Davey can't sell pay-per-views, but he's a TV superstar, maybe, I don't know.
There's a draw to Taker, I suppose, at this point.
And you got to remember the Nash thing is 2 minutes at the end of the show.
Yeah, I was about to say, yeah, what's the breakdown of the 2 hours?
And because they're still going with the fact, this notion of the outsiders, so they're not advertising appearances ahead of time.
Yeah, I was going to say, is that the way it was? It was still at this point, week three, is it?
Yeah, they did.
This is week three. Scott Hall had said the week before, I've got a big surprise buddy coming next week.
Yeah, they didn't really clear up the ambiguity until the Great American Bash with the Bischoff promo with the two, where he flat out asks them if they're still working for the WWF, and they both say no. I will note, and Liam's going to correct me if I'm wrong and I'm going to look like a complete moron, but I believe this is the last time that Raw would win the ratings war for a good 83 or 84 weeks, depending on who you listen to.
You are correct.
Vince McMahon has either come close to or has completed a deal with Ron Simmons, so he's got the blue helmet ready there for Ron.
Fuck, man.
So we're talking about what the WWF is trying to do to combat WCW and their influx of guys. Also expected to debut at the next tapings, Jim Neidhart with a new gimmick, Tracy Smothers, Tony Anthony, Alex Porto, Tom Brandy and Bill Irwin. Better known to you fans as Who, Freddie Joe Floyd, T.L. Harper, Alex Porto, Salvatore Sincere and The Goon.
They were all over WWF magazine at the time.
They were, weren't they? They got a whole big thing about the newcomers, and they were graded, if I recall correctly, in the magazines.
Yeah, you were right. I was wrong before. Now he's scraping the barrel.
the Bobby Dollar's new manager will debut soon. Oh. The only thing I've heard is there will be a man dressed up like a woman to feud with Sonny. So there you go. You get your China fix a year early.
What was the name?
I believe
Cloudy. Cloudy's the name.
With a K.
Much like the outlook for the company.
In this week's Observer, there are things that lead me to believe that it may not be Lex Luger after all, which is a mistake in my opinion. Rumours are flying it will be Jeff Jarrett, since Vince McMahon on the WWF hotline said Jarrett will be joining Hall & Nash in WCW.
You know, as a guest of the show, obviously it would have been fantastic still, Jeff, but I think probably Hulk Hogan probably worked for the best, I'll say on that one.
Yeah, he's looking to scale the mountain, but at this point he's not ready to be king.
June 16th, the Great American Bash. WCW is offering a fantastic show. 178,000 buys, so we've seen a bit of recovery from last month's Slamboree. Notable for a good few matches and a good few angles. Kevin Nash powerbombing Bischoff to death of the table. Mongo and Green against Flair and Arn, which is good. Sullivan and Benoit was a really good match on that show too. The debut of Rey Mysterio. A lot of good things to talk about on this show.
We commented on this when we were doing our reviews of the best non-Mania pay-per-views, and you just mentioned everything. I mean, as you said, this is the debut of Ray, which is obviously going to move the undercard of WCW into a certain direction. I thought the Regal Sting I thought was entertaining as well.
Yeah, it's a good match.
Benoit
Sullivan going to the women's bathroom, which Dusty Rhodes thought was the funniest thing ever.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not certain on the chronology of that as well. And how was things going with like the Nancy thing at this point?
They were starting it here.
Okay, and the main event is it's there.
Luger Giant.
It exists. For me, for some strange reason, I really love the Flair on
fun
Green
match.
It's just really fun. It's just the way he does it. And I think the moment this just makes me laugh all the time. I think Arn starts the match and they go through the usual beginnings and he tags in Flair, and Flair's just doing all his little struts. Green does shoulder tackles Flair 3 times in a row. And just Flair just pops up and just shouts at him and goes, "Come on!" You know, just shouts at him.
Yeah,
he's just lost.
That's right.
3 times in a row. Goes, "Come on!" Like he's just won. Yeah. And it's just like, this match is going to be great. This is like Flair and Arn are just going to be like on the money with this. Yeah. And Green in particular, Mongo is. But Green in particular showed a decent...
bit of promise.
Yeah, a bit of promise in the ring. You know, he was athletic and he kind of knew what he did. He was doing in there. I mean, okay, there's a lot of shoulder tackles in there, but. He was a footballer, for fuck's sake. I mean, but like, yeah, there's a lot more to Green than there was of Mongo at that time.
Debut of Rey Mysterio at this point, probably arguably the most spectacular wrestler I've ever seen.
Yeah.
At this point, goddamn, he was amazing.
Yeah, he actually blew my mind.
Unbelievable.
Too.
Not that it was, ever bad, but...
And the funny thing is, Meltzer's review, and granted, we're going by Meltzer's notes, but not that his word is gospel or anything, but I remember that his opinion at the time was that this is absolutely fairly unspectacular compared to what he's seen from Mysterio in Mexico. But to us, this scene against Dean Malenko is like, fuck me, look at what this guy's doing. This is out of this world.
And Malenko as well looked awesome working with guys. So you're really getting like the shape of the company now for the next few years. It's really setting now. Now we're looking, got some good guys underneath.
They clearly knew, I think, from the first few Nitros that didn't do well. We need to fill this out and put some of these guys on to show up the card.
As Kieran has said there, we see really the pattern for the next 2.5-3 years of what WCW is going to be. Great in-ring talent underneath and in the middle of the card. The established names that you've had in the main events before, but the established names still there with the cachet, even if the in-ring action isn't what you would hope for. And notable for the fact that you have Nash attack Bischoff.
That's the big thing for me on
this show. That's the big thing, because you've seen in WWF Vader's attacked Monsoon, but you've got Monsoon, who, whilst being an authority figure, is a former wrestler. And when you look at him stood next to Vader, there's not much in terms of height. You know, Monsoon's a big guy.
Yeah.
So it when you have Nash close to 7 foot attacking an announcer and putting him through powerbombing him through the stage, no less.
Yeah.
You know,
I've replayed that so many times.
In much the same way you look at the Mysterio stuff and your eyes pop out, you think, Jesus, we don't see this every week over here. By the same token, you don't see that happening to announcers.
No.
This is the weird thing. This is just shows how up and down WCW is. We were just talking about the Nitros, these first three Nitros, and how the mid card or the general shows just suck ass. And then they just bring out this card out of like almost nowhere with, you know, a great mid card.
Well, it's the benefit, you know, it's ATM Eric. It's the benefit of having Ted Turner's account and, you know, you can more or less spend what you want, because
to credit to themselves, like we said, they finally started turning a profit that was a real profit, not just a slight one like in 95. They were making a lot of money because of the added revenue from the extra hour and the house show business that had done well. They'd earned the money they were using. Yeah. To give some credit to them too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But as we know, the accountants over at the Turner Enterprise were not always tight on the purse strings.
Not at all, and I wouldn't imply such a thing. One last bit of feedback here from Mifune Jackson from the Wrestling Forum. Early 96 was a very dynamic time for both companies, mostly WCW, which was getting a lot more experimental and interesting around this time to me. The WWF had some glaring problems around this time. The Shawn Michaels push to me felt every bit as forced as the Roman Reigns push of today, except this was during a time where the live fans wouldn't call the WWF out on their crap. Michaels was just such a natural dickhead, and it really came off on screen. To make him the top babyface star, especially at the expense of Bret Hart, really turned me off the show. Even Shawn admits now how uninteresting his character was around this time, just like Reigns is currently. However, the WWF did bring back the Ultimate Warrior, and that got my interest for a while, and I was excited in the early goings of Vader's run. Still, the WWF started all the Huckster and Nacho Man crap, and it really came off like they were whining, while WCW was putting on the more interesting show. As much as I love the Warrior, the WWF came off like complete hypocrites for making fun of Hogan and Savage while bringing him in. Then, of course, the WWF loses Hall and Nash, Bret takes off, and WCW really starts to pick up steam. Even after Hall and Nash show up, WCW continues doing interesting things like the Great American Bash tag match with Flair and Arn versus Mongo and Green. There was also the beginnings of the Sullivan-Benoit feud, and also Rey Mysterio Jr. debuts in the Cruiserweight division got even better. The WWF was complacent, steadily slipping to number 2. A lot of their whining that still comes across in the Monday Night Wars doc was really amped up here, and they just came across as sore losers to a company that the majority was starting to tune into on a more regular basis. WCW wasn't perfect, but it was changing. The WWF was even worse and in dire need of change.
As you go through that first half of 96, for all the sort of crazy, for lack of a better term, things that WCW are doing with the changing of the belt and it opening the Nitro shows and, you know, all this stuff on free TV, you get the sense throughout that period WCW has found its footing. It knows what it is by the time we get to the end of June. They know what they're about. They know the structure that they want going forward. They've got the second hour. There is a sense, despite all the craziness that we know about through the dirt sheets, if you just look at the programming, there's a structure there, and they know they've got a semblance of a longer term vision. WWF throughout that period, even getting up to the end of June, they're flailing around. They're sending.
They're windmilling.
Yeah, they're windmilling. You know, Jerry McDevitt's working overtime issuing legal writs. They've got billionaire Ted skits. Brett's gone. They've lost the better talent at WCW. Their response is to bring in talent that, whilst it would reap rewards further down the line, isn't ready yet, and in some cases talent which just should never have been hired in the first place. So you just get the sense that WCW has a direction, but the WWF is still rudderless.
The following night from the Great American Bash, for probably the first time ever, word of mouth coming off a pay-per-view did a major number on the ratings. Nitro did a 3.4 to Raw's 2.3. In the head-to-head hour, it was WCW's largest margin of victory ever. After the 2.6 rating for Nash's debut, Kevin Sullivan, the booker, was totally in the doghouse to the point he wasn't even invited to the booking meeting on June 11th, and there was considerable speculation that his days were numbered. Of course, after this week, he's the company hero.
No way should he just underestimate that. That it was this current angle with the outsiders that was the real game changer in this. It's like WCW made enough right moves here and there, going to 2 hours, grabbing this guy, grabbing the luchadors, whatever. Change in the guard here, as you're saying, with the 83 to 84 weeks of dominance, was solely on this angle. As soon as they do the Great American Bash show, where they announce pretty much like, this is the angle, folks.
I just think, as Carl said, it was actually an interesting, relevant direction WCW got in there. Said it a million times about, you know, following the Shawn and liking the main events of WWF at the time, but they had no talent. And WCW, yeah, they had more talent, but on top, personally, it was, again, seen it, done it. They're going around in circles with various guys filling in. Now it was guys who actually aren't going 50-50 or... just lost in an up and mid card shuffle. It was the two huge stars with a purposeful direction behind them and something interesting, fresh. And as we said, everything that had gone on with the war at this point, it was just preface for or prologue for those two coming in. And once people really got a taste of what it was, it kind of almost took on a life on its own, I think.
June 17th at Raw, Brian Pillman debuts doing the one-minute contract signing, acting as a babyface in tears, and then immediately turned heel, which should air the coming week. As it turned out, he did the crying, thank you very much, and then as the crowd applauded, he went, shut the hell up!
Okay, and I only saw the first bit.
they only aired that on Raw. They aired the rest on Superstars, and he just absolutely just eviscerated the company. It was awesome. Great promo.
Well, there you go. Speaking of a company that's flailing, they air that bit on Raw, but the interesting bit airs on Superstars.
Titan Sports, on June 20th, filed a lawsuit and a request for a restraining order against Turner Broadcasting, WCW, and Eric Bischoff, largely as a result of the WCW top angle involving Hall and Nash. They sued them on charges of false and misleading descriptions of fact that is likely to cause confusion in the marketplace, trademark infringement on Scott Hall, constant disparagement of WWF on TV, and defamation for the power cutter accusation. There were so many ridiculous requests in the lawsuit, but among the more funny ones are that Kevin Nash had to shave his goatee off because Diesel had one. Needless to say, this was thrown out eventually, although it would go on for quite a long time.
Bischoff referenced the lawsuit on air, didn't he, as well?
Yeah.
Interesting as well, what it's doing, it's kind of getting Bischoff over more as well as this character. You know, the powerbomb through a table is still on an announcer, but little things he'd said, obviously with the jabs at Vince, it was very much hit. You knew it was him saying it.
That's why, even in retrospect, not to cut you off, but I think it's so important to note that after all these jabs Bischoff had taken at the WWF, for Nash to powerbomb him, it was fucking perfect. This leads to the King of the Ring on June 23rd, near the end of June, 150,000 buy, so a slight increase from Beware of Dog, but not up to the levels of In Your House 7 with Diesel. Austin 316, Steve wins the King of the Ring, Brian Pillman does do a heel promo on the show. I actually enjoyed this pay-per-view quite a bit. Probably the WWF's best offering of the year up to this point.
It is. It is probably the best show up to this point, because there are better ones later on. But it's by no imaginations should that be a glowing praise, because the only real things that come out of that show from when I remember watching it recently is, yeah, you had a Shawn Davey Boy main event, and the only other thing was obviously the Austin promo at the end, and that was pretty much about it. You know, his lips gets busted open, goes to the hospital, well, get it sewn up.
That's a little rough.
I can't really remember anything else.
I think you're being a bit. It's ironic me saying this, but I think you're being a bit harsh on it. The Michaels Bulldog match is very good. It's a very good match. Austin's opener with Mero, I don't
underrated.
Think gets the praise it should.
Very underrated.
I'm not calling it a five-star classic by any means, but again, another good match. You've got the, I say the significance of the Austin promo. They didn't run with him initially on that, you know. By SummerSlam, he's wrestling on the free for all, but at least he lets you know he's there.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
This is a guy that's going to be relevant. And you've got the, we talked about it earlier, and the Undertaker and Mankind, and this is the guy that's coming in to do the job for Taker. Mankind wins. I think that's not incredibly significant, okay, but it's significant.
It's very noteworthy.
It's noteworthy
given the tenor of the times.
Because this is a guy who's been on TV in the company, you know, since, you know, he's been there what, 3 months, just shy of 3 months, and he's beaten the Undertaker with a mandible claw. No one would have foreseen that, and it breathes new life into the Undertaker character as you go through 96.
Absolutely. Also on the show, like I said, Brian Pillman does a great crazy promo on Jim Ross, swearing liberally.
Plunder, rape, pillage and plunder.
Yeah.
And just a nice shout out to Owen Hart, who is hilarious.
He's
on commentary.
He's great on commentary. It's also got Ahmed beating Goldust for the Continental title in a landmark moment, probably the peak of Ahmed's career, I would guess, at this point. Thank you, Dave Meltzer, for this note, because this is hilarious. Bischoff, Hall and Nash were discussing names for the third man this week since the original plan, Lex Luger, has been dropped. The top candidate is Mabel. Who had been fired by the WWF earlier in the year. Crush was also considered for a brief period and then dismissed. All agreed that Bret Hart would probably be the best candidate.
Yeah.
But Hart turned down every offer thrown his way. Supposedly Bischoff has in the past few days told Hall and Nash to trust him on this one. It could also be a WCW wrestler turning on the company. Nitro on June 24th, largely a waste of time, notes Meltzer. The main event is Harlem Heat, winning the tag team titles over Sting and Luger and the Steiners, where Nash and Hall come out, upper right,
with the bats.
Which ends with the Charlotte police officers in the ring with their hands on their guns in the standoff, which I love that angle.
That's a great, great angle to end the show.
It is awesome. Even though the show really dragged, Nitro still handily beat the WWF in the ratings, which is a big deal because it came after a major pay-per-view event for the WWF. Nitro gets a 3.2 to Raw's 2.7. On opposition, Raw had Ahmed versus Triple H, the Body Donners versus the Brooklyn Brawler and Jerry Fox, Vader, Bulldog and Owen Hart against Aldo, Savio and Barry Horowitz, and Taker versus Steve Austin in a long, boring match, unfortunately, according to Dave Meltzer. So.
Taker by DQ, was it? I think.
Goldust throws something in his eyes.
Yeah,
blows the gold dust in his
gold
eyes.
Dustins, yeah. Gold,
get it?
Yeah.
And the final note here, the final note on the timeline, June 30th. The Ultimate Warrior is gone. Once again, he features in question after he missed the weekend house show dates and the death of his father. The gossip among the wrestlers was that he was unhappy with his WrestleMania payoff and the WWF merchandising him on a deal that he didn't know about. The WWF called Bret Hart to cover the Warrior on his house shows, but he said no, so they called Sid. And unfortunately, that would play in, I guess, softball season's over at this point. They would later call Sid in July to come back full time, but the Warrior's gone here after a very, very brief period.
We hardly knew ye.
Yeah, he did make a difference on ratings, though, for a very short period of time, and he probably was the second biggest attraction at WrestleMania that year, as bizarre as it seems, the return of the Warrior. He had some life to him, but it was just... At this point... Oh, God, that was a horrible choice of words, wasn't it?
Yeah, I wasn't for sure.
By King of the Ring... By King of the Ring, they put him in that kind of rather horrible feud with Jerry Lawler. I think they were going to go with him and Vader that fall for the title was the plan at the time, because they were still thinking Vader was going to get the belt. But they were doing they were not doing too much with Warrior at the time.
They were doing his Warrior University deal.
They were plugging it to the hilt. But Warrior's gone. He does not return to the WWF.
Just think how much he could have contributed if they would have just bought copies of the comic book.
I know, isn't that disgraceful? Always believe. So that pretty much wraps up June. As we come to this point, the WCW has finally turned the corner in terms of establishing a firm advantage, even though the momentum was going back and forth pretty much the entire 6 months. This very much goes on to the 1995 podcast as the prologue to what would eventually become the real Monday Night War, which is just about kicked off. But again, the WWF's kind of trying to find themselves here. WCW's got something. They know they got something. Very interesting period of time. Any final thoughts on this 6 months?
The direction of the company outside of Sean's Got the Belt is kind of very lacking. I mean, you just commented there about, oh, they still have plans to put Vader with the belt. Really? They're not fucking behaving like that. So it's just like, everything's just like, yeah, this is supposed to happen, but there's no conviction in anything. Whilst in WCW, there's conviction everywhere. The only thing they got to fill in is who that third man is.
Hey, I think if you're scoring points, you know, as they like to use the cliche at this point, WCW are well ahead. In terms of potential, I mean, WWE's getting thinner, WF, sorry, is getting thinner all the time.
Except
Vader. Apart from WCW, it's the start of a interesting long journey for them. And I think if you probably asked most people at this time, they'd probably say if one side's coming out of the war alive, it'd probably be WCW at this point, and probably a situation which would increase over the months ahead.
Yeah, just to echo the rest of the table, WCW's troops are amassed, they're marching forward, whereas the WWF are much like the French military and they're retreating at a vigorous pace.
And on that note, I want to thank everybody for listening this far and for all the feedback that we got. If we didn't get to it this time, I apologise, but this has been a hell of a journey. We've covered so much ground. If you like this, again, email us at scgradio@hotmail.com and ask for the next instalment and we shall get to it. So, for Kieran O'Rourke,
Iranu,
for Carl Jones,
Uvavu,
and for Ji-Chun Chase,
au revoir, WWF.
I am Liam O'Rourke and we are out of here. It's a shame Vic Mews doesn't have a third catchphrase. Yeah.